I call this meeting to order of the Committee on Health and Human Service Policy. Can we please take our seats, members, and a quorum is present. May I have a motion to approve the meetings for February the 12th?
So moved.
No.
Okay. Representative Albright moves approval of the minutes for Tuesday, February the 12th. Any discussion? Hearing no's, hearing none. Those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for Tuesday, February the 12th, are approved. So we have our first bill moving, House File 679, Representative Morrison. Please go ahead and move your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that House File 679 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right. So we have the bill before the committee. Is there anyone? Oh. Can you explain the bill, please?
Yes, Madam Chair. House File 679 addresses an urgent need to assure funding for children's residential mental health services for May and June of 2019. This is a little bit of an unusual situation, so let me give some quick background. State funds were appropriated in the 2017 budget, passed in the special session to sustain children's residential mental health services in anticipation of an IMD designation by CMS. Unfortunately, for the math to work for the special session agreement, 2 months for the biennium, May and June of 2019, were left unfunded in anticipation of funding these 2 remaining months in the 2018 session. Though there was bipartisan agreement to fund these 2 months in 2018, funding was vetoed as part of the final omnibus spending bill last session. Now the issue is timing. Children and youth needing this level of care, their families, counties responsible to place them for treatment, and service providers all need reassurance that the state will keep its commitment and provide the needed state funding to assure services will be delivered this spring. Passing the needed $470,000 in funding early in the session will send a signal that serving kids in need of intensive mental health treatment is a priority.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for bringing this bill forward. Do we have any testifiers?
I do not.
Okay. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on House File 679? Okay. Is there any discussion from the committee? Any questions? Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Morrison, for carrying this important bill. I just wanted to give just a bit more context to members about what this is. So the IMD that, we use so many acronyms around here, the IMD that Representative Morrison mentioned. So what happened is under federal law, there's a rule that says that if you have more than 16 beds in a mental health facility, that it's designated an institute for mental disease, which is something that we are not supposed to have anymore. So in other words, the federal government does not share in the funding of that when you have a facility that is larger than the rules. So that's what this is about. The federal government had finally disallowed funding for some of these residential treatment centers that are for children with very, very high mental health needs. And they're all around the state. I forget how many of them there are, but the bottom line is that the state has to fund them without federal participation. So that's what we're talking about here. The 2 months of funding that Representative Morrison was discussing are left for just this biennium, and then we're going to as well have to consider what we're going to do going forward, because this is something that's falling only in the state budget. So I just wanted to give that little bit of context, Madam Chair, because this is the policy committee, and so there is a policy issue here, even though the bill doesn't necessarily say so. That's really about that IMD issue and the fact that these children, we have to make sure they get the care they need, and we're going to have to do something going forward. So that's
it. Thank you, Chair Liebling, for that explanation of the policy in this bill. This really, really is an important issue. Thank you so much. Is there any further discussion? Being no further discussion, Representative Morrison renews her motion that House File 679 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion prevails. House File 679 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Representative Morrison. Okay. All right, so we have our next bill up. Representative Cantrell with House File 12. I just would like to maybe do a little information about how we're going to run this portion in this committee. So before we begin the next bill, I want to lay out that this hearing, as you can see, there's much interest in this issue. We have several folks who wants to testify on this bill, and so we're going to have Representative Cantrell make some opening remarks and quickly explain what the bill does. We're then going to take the remainder of our normal committee time until 4:15 today and divide that time into two even blocks of time for testimonies. The first block of time would be for people to speak in support of the bill, and the second block of time for people wishing to express concerns or opposition to the bill. We will work through the list of scheduled testifiers on the agenda first, and then if there is any time remaining for each block, we will welcome additional testimony from the audience. We will recess for members to attend caucus at 4:15, then reconvene in this room later this evening for the committee for further discussion on the bill. For those testifying today, I ask that you keep your remarks concise so that we can have as many people as possible testify on both sides of this bill. And so, with that, the chair moves that House File 12 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee of Commerce on Commerce. We have the bill before the committee. Welcome, Representative Cantrell. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, today I present to the committee House File 12, a bill to protect children, vulnerable adults, and all patients in Minnesota from fraudulent ex-gay therapy, also known as conversion therapy. Although I am using the word therapy in reference to the medically unsound practices and techniques that this bill will ban, there is nothing therapeutic about conversion therapy. And my testifiers will explain to you why that is. Conversion therapy, for the purposes of this bill, is defined as techniques administered by a mental health professional or mental health practitioner to an individual with the ultimate goal of changing an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. This bill does not define conversion therapy as a therapy or a therapeutic interaction in which an individual seeks to understand, explore, gain a better comprehension of what their gender identity and sexuality is. So I just want to say that kind of right off the bat. Our testifiers will go into detail about the medically discredited techniques employed by practitioners of conversion therapy and why conversion therapy is not only an unfounded unscientific practice, but a severely damaging one as well. In advance of their testimony, I want to thank all of our testifiers, but I especially want to thank Roger, Junior, and Will, all of whom are survivors of conversion therapy, for the strength and courage to share your experiences with all of us today. Because of your bravery, we will be taking the next step in protecting future generations of patients in Minnesota from having to experience the truly horrific treatment you endured and the lifelong harm that that treatment has caused yourselves and countless others. And with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to my first testifier, Ms. McBride.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McBride. Can you please reintroduce yourself, identify yourself and who you represent, and begin with your testimony, please?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Emma McBride. I work in policy and legislative affairs at Outfront Minnesota, which is the largest and leading LGBTQ organization in the state. We're here today because of conversion therapy survivors who have come forward to share their stories. Survivors like Garrett Conley.
Mrs. McBride, could you pull the microphone closer to you?
Is that good?
Better. Thank you.
Great. We're here today because of conversion therapy survivors who have come forward to share their stories. Survivors like Garrett Conley, author of Boy Erased, whose harrowing story of surviving conversion therapy sparked national attention. And survivors like the ones who will share their story today, Will, Roger, and Junior. These have been some of the hardest stories that we have ever had to hear, and some of the greatest resilience that we've ever seen. Outfront Minnesota's mission is to create a state where lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people are free to be who they are, love who they love, and live in a state without fear of violence, discrimination, or harassment. We work towards this mission every single day. We answer hundreds of calls on our crisis hotline every year, train thousands of teachers and administrators across the state, and organize people to show up for pro-LGBTQ candidates and policies. Because of the hard work of our members, Minnesota is one of the nation's leaders on LGBTQ equity. But when our state still allows discredited, fraudulent therapy that harms our community, we know that we still have a really long way to go. Conversion therapy includes a range of dangerous and discredited practices aimed at changing a person's sexual orientation, gender identity, or gender expression. These harmful practices are based on the false claim that being LGBTQ is a mental illness. Every single major medical association and doctors you'll hear from today have denounced these practices, and the UN has likened this to torture. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we ask you to join us in our mission to ensure LGBTQ people can thrive in our state and are free from harm, especially from those that we seek care from. And we invite you to join us and make sure that no child goes to sleep at night thinking that they inherently are wrong and they need to change in order to be loved and accepted. Today, the committee will hear from many of our coalition members, doctors, mental health practitioners, faith leaders, and survivors themselves. This is reflective of the broad and hardworking coalition that we have built with people from all walks of life who recognize that LGBTQ people are born perfect and need no cure. This coalition grows every day. Just in the last 24 hours, our coalition sent over 10,000 emails to the committee members before us today, asking them to support the Mental Health Protections Act, in addition to the 500-plus Valentines that will be delivered. The message is loud and clear. Conversion therapy has no place in Minnesota. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. McBride, for your testimony. So what we're going to do from here, we have about 45 minutes for each side to have testimonies. We have my committee administrator here, Mr. McCall, who will keep time and we will provide updates on how much time is remaining for each side, just to make sure everyone get an opportunity to speak. For the members, I would like for you maybe to hold your questions until after the testimonies on each side, just to ensure that since we have lots of folks here who I'm sure wants to have their voices heard, that we can allow that to happen. All right?
Madam Chair.
Yeah, and we will go through questions once we reconvene.
Madam Chair, can I just ask really quickly, could there be some concession made if a testifier is not able to come back this evening?
Well, yes, that's the hope that we get to all the testifiers.
I know, but for questioning, if a testifier is not, I mean, if they can indicate if they can be here, then that would be helpful. But if the testifiers can't be here tonight, then there's not much
to discuss.
Absolutely,
I agree. And if someone has traveled from a distance, and that can be a reason why they cannot, we will also want to honor that, too. Yeah, thank you. So thank you, Ms. McBride.
Thank you.
I'm going to call the next testifier. Will Burstrom, Samson Burstrom. And also Roger Sanchez, can you come down, please, too? Ms. McBride, can we get Will Bergstrom to replace your seat?
Yes. I'm going to stay up here with him as a support, if that is
okay. A support. Okay. All right. Please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you're with, and we're ready to hear your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Will Sampson Bergstrom. I use he, him pronouns. I am an elder at Apple Valley Community of Christ in Apple Valley, and I am a survivor of conversion therapy. From 2006 to 2010, I participated in a variety of types of conversion therapy. Some sessions occurred in church offices. Some were in licensed mental health facilities. My parents would be present for some sessions. During those times, we would search for an unresolved trauma from my past that might explain my illness. And when my parents weren't there, the conversation would turn to them. What had they done to cause so much anger and resentment that I would believe the lie that I was gay? When I was asked to leave or kicked out of my private Christian school following my public outing in 2009, I offered to return to conversion therapy, I think is repentance. But for the next, every Thursday for over a year, I would go back to Panama City, Florida, to visit with a licensed therapist who at times would perform a practice called theophostic or transformative prayer ministry, which I liken to hypnosis. We pray for God to bring up these lies from my past. And almost like with your DVR remote, we deleted those memories. And I can't explain what that looks like or feels like. But I know that to this day, there are spots in my brain that when I try to remember my life, my family, they're just, I see the bright light that was supposed to represent the love of Christ. My family and I are much, much better today. My dad married my husband and I at our church. My mom made phone calls during the Vote No campaign a few years ago. And I live a life with a lot of joy in it. But that doesn't take away from the years of development that I was told I was a threat and dangerous to other people, and that I lived a sin that I had the power to change. And it wasn't true. My parents and I were lied to, and fraud was committed against my family, and it's happening today in Minnesota. And I thank you all for hearing my story and the other stories that you're going to hear. Please protect us. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We really appreciate it. Roger. And Junior Avalos. Okay, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
excuse me. My name is Jose Roger Sanchez, but I go by Roger Sanchez. I work as an educator here in Minnesota, in White Bear Lake, and I grew up in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I grew up thinking that being gay was wrong, and I was told that directly and indirectly throughout my childhood. There came a time when I came forward about being gay. At the time, I called it same-sex attraction. My father told me that it was wrong and that it needed to be changed. My bishop at the time recommended conversion therapy. I did not know any better. I did not know where to turn, but to the people that had raised me and to my church leaders, and so I consented. I told someone before, like a lamb to the slaughter, I went forth with conversion therapy. What happened during those years, it was a rewire. They were trying to rewire me to why I was the way I was and to why I was gay. And they validated that it was wrong. They what I thought to be someone who was licensed and a professional and that knew what they were talking about, they validated that being gay was wrong. And I bought into it, and I thought there was something wrong with me. And for many years after, it tormented me to the point of contemplating suicide, to the point of wanting to change my life. And I would drink just to try to forget it because nobody wanted me. And I felt that I was alone and that I needed to change. And it took one person to help me realize that there was nothing wrong with me. And I, for so many years, also believed that God didn't love me and that God had abandoned me, because I prayed and I tried to change and I tried to do everything they would tell me so I can change, and it wasn't working. So I felt that I was a defect. But I came to realize that God's not going to judge me for who I love. He's going to judge me for the content of my heart and who I am, and that He created me perfectly. And He makes no mistake. So I'm here today to say that conversion therapy is wrong, and that I want to make sure that people do not go through the same thing. I was robbed of a childhood. I was robbed of my early 20s to not be able to love who I love, and I still struggle with it to this day. There's too many things I still struggle with, and I work through it. And I've gone to people who practice real therapy to help me realize that I am perfect and that I can get through this. So I ask you to help the young people and who are being preyed upon. Their parents are being preyed upon by the pseudoscience that they can change when they cannot. Thank you for hearing me today.
And thank you for your testimony. Thank you. Junior? And Dr. Adelholden? Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Junior Avalos, legally Ernest. I work for Outfront, and I'm an organizer for them, but I'm here as a survivor of conversion therapy. From the age of 10 to 15, I went through spiritual guidance. From a young age, I knew that the love that I presented was different, and I was told it was wrong, and I was pressured into thinking that, one, I was a monster, that as a 10-year-old, I was perverted, I was disgusting, and as a little 10-year-old, I hated myself. And as I continued to go through this spiritual guidance, I couldn't change the feelings that I had. And at 13, I officially bursted out saying I'm gay. And I hid in secret for 2 years until a family member found out that I was gay. And it led to a physical altercation. Cops were called. And when the cop asked for my statement, I told him what happened. And he said, there's camps that can fix you. I'm originally from Houston, Texas. And I was going through so much at that time that I just wanted to be loved by the people that I thought that I loved. I just wanted to be normal. I wanted to live a happy life. I was sick and tired of the abuse, harassment that I was going through. And so at 16, I looked up, I Googled, and I was like, how to be straight. And a camp popped up. It was in Texas. And so I applied to get into it, and I went to this camp. I took a bus all by myself from Houston to Austin, got picked up at the bus station by some random people that I was communicating with to attend this camp. And when it first arrived, it's like any summer camp, I thought. It had a nice little, nice cabins by a lake in the forest. But the experiences that I had there were horrendous. It was a mix of religious leaders and supposedly ex-gays and people that were saying that they could fix me and that they could cure me of whatever disease I had. When I got there, they tried to lower our guards by using language that would make us feel safe, that we were being welcomed, that we were in some sort of brotherhood here on the same journey. And they used language like this to at some point attack us and make us feel worse than how we arrived. Examples of that would be that they thought they could condition us, and as Roger mentioned, rewire how our minds work. They try to use repetition by throwing slurs at us. And another example is that they would make us practice mannerisms that were masculine, and if we had a limp wrist, if our voices went up too high, we risked the possibility of being physically assaulted. And to follow that, a lot of the hypocrisy that was here, a lot of these ex-gay people were also coming into our cabins at night and sexually assaulting us. So I came out feeling worse. I came out still with the same feelings. I came out feeling like I wasn't going to change. I came out with suicidal thoughts. I came out with anxiety. I came out with so many disturbed feelings. I was thinking of how I could make it easy to kill myself, how to be able to also do it without hurting my family and stuff like that. That experience alone was from people that had no medical background, had no license to practice any sort of therapy. They beat us up like dogs, thinking they could change us. They treated me and beat me up like a dog instead of a human being. As a 16-year-old, I was treated like a dog. And it's not fair that a kid has to go through that. It's not fair, but following the camp, I had also planned to attend a dance intensive in Philadelphia. And by some miracle, I ended up in the heart of gayborhood in Philadelphia and right during their pride. And I got to see that people that were like me, queer, trans, lesbian, gay people, could live happy lives, that they could smile and that they could be out and proud and just not have to face any sort of, not any hate. I was lied that at some point I died of AIDS. I was told that, I was never going to live a happy life, but I was going to live a promiscuous life, and that I was just going to never find a true love, and that I couldn't get what my heterosexual counterparts got, or that I couldn't be like my straight friends, that I was still perverted. But I saw that I could be happy, so I stood at 2 years of high school, and I wanted to leave. I wanted to be in a place where I could live myself authentically. I applied to 23 colleges across the country, and I ended up here in Minnesota because I decided to attend a small Lutheran college where I was welcomed and I could be who I was. I got to amend my relationship with my faith because of the people here at this college. And I got to, during the summers that I would be here in Minneapolis doing internships, I got to continue to see that I could be happy being a person of faith, being queer, being able to live an authentic life, because I would attend University Baptist Church by the U of M and see that I could live happily. I found my community here. I saw that Minnesota could be such a big trailblazer for LGBTQ issues, and yet we still have this issue where there's multiple professional clinics across the state, and even here in the Twin Cities, where they offer stuff like this, and it's not fair that kids, 12-year-olds, young people, and even adults have to face through this. We say that words can have such an impact, and these words can literally lead us to kill ourselves, to end our lives and lose. And it's not fair that we have to continuously come up here and beg to be treated like human beings. And I thank you for hearing my story.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Okay. Dr. Johnson, please introduce yourself and let's go with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholt.
I'm sorry, give me one moment. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We have 6 testifiers in 30 minutes. So that's going to try to stick to the concise and make sure we get everyone a chance to speak. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'm Sue Averholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and just want to note I'm not a doctor. I have my master's, but not a doctorate.
Ooh, okay.
And I'm here representing NAMI Minnesota and the entire Mental Health Legislative Network, which is a coalition of over 40 mental health-related organizations. And I'm here to express our support for banning what is called reparative or conversion therapy. Every single major mental health organization, the psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, counselors, support a ban on the use of conversion therapy. Even the Federal Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration issued a report against the use of conversion therapy. The reason for the opposition to conversion therapy is easy. Therapy is used to treat the symptoms of mental illnesses, such as bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. Being lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or queer is not considered a mental illness, so there is no illness to treat. The idea that same-sex attraction and orientation among some adolescents is in any way abnormal or mentally unhealthy has no support among any mainstream health and mental health professional organization. The use of these so-called therapies, particularly on youth, to change, when mentioned, to change, not explore, but to change their sexual orientation can cause serious potential harm to young people and is viewed by mental health professionals to be dangerous. Lack of support for youth or rejecting who they are has a negative impact on their mental health, including leading to depression, anxiety, substance use disorder, and suicide. There are no studies demonstrating the efficacy of this treatment, just their harm. So it's time to put a stop to these therapies and support the mental health of young people who are exploring, defining, and articulating their identity. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And please, Dr. Petiso, maybe? And you can proceed. Introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Andy Johnson. I'm Associate Professor of Psychology at Bethel University. My doctorate is in counseling psychology from the University of Notre Dame. My APA-approved internship was at Pinerest Christian Hospital in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I serve currently as member-at-large for the Society for the Psychology, Religion, and Spirituality of the American Psychological Association, and just this month accepted the nomination to run for president of that society. I'm not a stranger to the interface between religion and psychology. I'm here today to enthusiastically support passage of the Mental Health Protections Act. This is not about religion. This is about stopping mental health malpractice. Sexual orientation change efforts, also referred to as conversion therapy or reparative therapy, are psychological interventions designed to change the sexual orientation or gender identity of LGBT persons. These therapies are ineffective and harmful. What do we mean by ineffective? Research has shown that these therapies are not successful in changing one's sexual orientation or gender identity. What do we mean by harmful? Research with adults who've gone through conversion therapies consistently shows that individuals have higher rates of depression, higher rates of suicidal ideation, higher rates of suicide attempts, and higher levels of substance abuse. Recent research on adolescents who have experienced conversion therapies showed a similar pattern with depression and increased suicide risk and also lower educational attainment. The reparative therapies and conversion therapies have been disavowed by all major health and mental health organizations, including the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, and so on. The packet we gave you has a partial listing of these. I think they left out one or two when I looked at it last night. So in summary, these positions came about because basically of two things. One is scientific evidence, and the other is the medical principle of above all or first, do no harm. Minnesota has a long, proud tradition of leadership in health and mental health care. That's something I'm very proud of in being a resident of this state. This is a wonderful opportunity to continue in that legacy by passing legislation to stop mental health malpractice, which is found not only to be ineffective, but also harmful and damaging to individuals who are in a vulnerable situation. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Appreciate it. Okay, please introduce yourself, and I'm going to call down Dr. Lynch.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Pazzo. I am a pediatric hospital physician and community pediatrician. I work at CentraCare in St. Cloud. I was educated at the University of Minnesota and the University of Iowa. I represent the broad swath of the medical community within Minnesota. I am the past president of the Minnesota chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics, and I currently serve on the Minnesota Medical Association Board of Trustees. I am pleased today to offer support of the medical community in Minnesota to House File 12, the bill that we are talking about today. As you have already heard, a long list of the nation's preeminent medical organizations that represent physicians and mental health practitioners recognize the potential dangers of conversion therapy. This list includes others that have already been mentioned, but also the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, the American College of Physicians, the American Psychiatric Association, to mention just a few. These organizations have recognized that homosexuality and gender diverse identities are not pathological disease states, but rather variations of normal human sexuality. LGBTQ people are our neighbors, our friends, our colleagues, our family members. Conversion therapy, as already explained, presumes that something central to a person's identity is wrong or abnormal. There's no scientific evidence to support a need for conversion therapy. The concept of conversion therapy lacks scientific credibility and clinical usefulness. Research paints a clear picture of its potential harm to adolescents and young adults. It can lead to poor self-esteem, self-harm, guilt, anxiety, depression, and suicide, all the while being an ineffective therapy. I personally have cared for young people in the hospital with serious mental health issues related to their struggles with gender identity, compounded by family confusion, family lack of support, isolation and bullying at school, and social stigma. Conversion therapy compounds these problems that these young people already deal with. When adolescents question their sexual identity, it is entirely appropriate for them and their parents and guardians to seek counseling and assistance from mental health professionals. Studies have demonstrated that gay and lesbian adolescents have higher rates than their heterosexual peers of mental health concerns, including depression and suicide. Positive interventions can lead to resiliency and success in reaching stable, productive adult life. However, conversion therapy is not the answer. It is coercive, dangerous, and ineffective. So on behalf of the state's physician community, I urge your support of this important legislation. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I would be happy to take questions later.
All right. Thank you so much. Okay, Doctor, I'm going to also, in the meantime, call down Pastor Comstock. And after that would be Reverend Davis.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Patty Lynch. I am not a doctor. I am trained as a clinical social worker. I have a master's in social work. I've been licensed as a clinical social worker for more than 25 years, and I currently have a private practice in Rochester, Minnesota. I am testifying today in support of the Health Care Protection Act. It will ensure that LGBTQ individuals receive care that is affirming, culturally competent, and ethical. The bill will eliminate the practice of conversion therapy in Minnesota. This bill should be passed because the practice is harmful. My professional organization, the National Association of Social Workers, condemns the use of so-called reparative therapy by any agency that identifies as providing social work services. The NASW stance is against treatments designed to change sexual orientation or gender identity and against referring clients to practitioners that provide such treatment. At present, about one half of the clients I see identify as LGBTQ. Many of them are referred to me from the Mayo Clinic Transgender and Intersex Specialty Care Clinic and from other therapists who want their clients to receive specialized affirmative care, which is the standard. Affirmative care encourages resilience and promotes self-compassion. In contrast, the focus of conversion therapy is to treat LGBTQ individuals with criticism and shame. Conversion or reparative therapy has been discredited or criticized by all major medical and mental health organizations. The letter submitted to this committee by Jane Wheeler, JD, opposing this bill, presents erroneous information to support her opinion. For example, citing a small observational study, she states that over 80% of prepubescent children with gender dysphoria or gender variant expression who are not socially transitioned resolve their dysphoria and do not go on to medically transition. This research is based upon a selected non-randomized group of 25 male adolescents. Citing a statistic of 80% is meaningless outside of that small group. The writer ignores the growing body of evidence that young children thrive when given permission to live in the gender that is most authentic and are at risk for symptomatic behaviors if prevented from doing so. The people I treat often have emotional pain caused by a conflict between a desire to be who they are and external pressure to be someone other than who they are. They need to be accepted, cherished, loved, and validated, not shamed. Please pass the Health Care Protection Act to ensure that LGBTQ people receive the best mental health care we have to offer. Thank you very much.
And thank you so much. Okay, please introduce yourself and Reverend Davis. Yes, okay.
Madam Chair and honored members of the committee, I am Reverend David Comstock and have been an ordained Presbyterian minister for 35 years. I'm a member of the Presbytery of the Twin Cities area, and I am the transitional lead pastor of the Minnetonka United Methodist Church, a 500-member church in the western suburbs. I come before you on behalf of my Methodist congregation, the Presbytery of the Twin Cities area, and scores of Protestant clergy and congregations around the state of Minnesota to encourage you to support and enact HF 12. You have in your packet an official resolution passed overwhelmingly by my presbytery and by over 12 other congregations. Other congregations are still in the process of deliberating about that resolution. As Christians, we believe that we are called by both the Hebrew and the Christian scriptures and by the example of Jesus to stand with outsiders, the aliens, the outcasts, and the vulnerable. We believe that this legislation is an important tool by which vulnerable LGBTQ youth and the adults who love them can be protected from a dangerous and ineffective practice. The fact that this practice is primarily promoted by persons and institutions bearing the name of Christ makes it all the more imperative that we speak up clearly against this misguided practice and for the legislation that is now before you. The obvious group of vulnerable persons, of course, are LGBTQ youth who, not wishing to lose the love and shelter of their families, feel that they cannot refuse it. However, the parents of those youth who fear for the future happiness of their children and feel helpless to save them are also vulnerable to the false claims of a cure for something that is not, in fact, either an illness nor a defect. We believe that it is the proper role of the state to stand between the vulnerable and those who offer options that are both false and harmful. Opponents of this legislation will certainly claim that this legislation somehow restricts the freedom of religious expression. The people of faith that I represent believe that this is a specious argument. While all of our constitutional freedoms are sacred, none of them is absolute. My freedom of speech is limited by statutes concerning speech that endangers others, speech that is libelous or slanderous, or speech that is seditious. This legislation does not attempt to restrict the freedom of religious groups to teach the truth as they understand it, nor can it reasonably be expected to have that effect. It does seek to restrict a practice that has been shown to be both dangerous and ineffective, and which has been condemned by every professional medical psychological association. Madam Chair, when I was a boy, my great uncle Eldon used to remind me that my right to ball my hand into a fist and to swing my arm ended at the end of someone else's nose. Conversion therapy is a fist that has struck over 700,000 Americans square in the face. Speaking as a Minnesota faith leader, speaking as a Christian, speaking as a father and as a grandfather, I implore you to restrain that fist and to encourage you to endorse HF 12 and to commend it for approval by the House of Representatives. Thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself.
I am Reverend Dwayne Davis, pastor of All God's Children Metropolitan Community Church. Honorable Madam Chair, honorable members of the committee, I am proud to be the pastor of All God's Children Metropolitan Community Church, which was founded in 1974 as a safe, welcoming, and affirming community of faith for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, many of whom were kicked out of their communities of faith because of their sexuality or gender identity. They came to All God's Children, founded it, so they can come to be community, not to find a cure, for there was nothing to be cured. On behalf of the 200 members of All God's Children, I respectfully ask for your support and affirmative vote for HF 12, the Mental Health Protections Act, to protect vulnerable LGBTQ youth from dangerous, discredited, and ineffective practice, the so-called conversion therapy. For 45 years, All God's Children has been embracing, serving, and empowering LGBTQ people who want to reclaim and practice their faith fully and proudly. Every week, however, we welcome survivors of this dangerous practice who struggle to see their beauty and their worthiness because so-called therapists tore them down and stripped them of all of their dignity in an attempt to change them into something that they are not. Every month, I visit with LGBTQ people in recovery, many of whom trace their struggles with depression, substance abuse, and self-harm to the horrible experiences of so-called conversion therapy. Every few months, I receive a call or a letter from a scared teenager or young adult desperate for some sign of hope and affirmation so they can endure one more hour of dehumanizing so-called treatments to change them. And I have sat with chapters of PFLAG, parents and friends of lesbian and gays, throughout the United States, in which parents tell traumatizing stories of pastors and churches pressuring and demanding that parents push their children into horrible conversion programs or risk losing their communities of faith. At All God's Children, we affirm each individual as God's unique and gifted creation. We share the love of God with all people just as they are. And as a minister of the Christian gospel, I can testify to the beauty and transformation that faith makes possible. But as a black man, I can also tell you of the debilitating harm and trauma that religion can cause when it gets it wrong. I am the son of Pentecostal parents who lived and thrived during Jim Crow Mississippi. And in the name of religion, they could not vote, they could not have public accommodations, and people declare that it was because of the Bible and God that it be so. So I know the dangers of a religion run amok. History and experience show that many have distorted and abused the sacred freedoms of speech and religion to hold slaves, to enforce segregation, and to exclude and demonize LGBTQ people. Do not allow people to use God or the freedoms of speech and religion to do harm to vulnerable people. Rather, I implore you, members of this committee, to listen to the survivors. Listen to Will. Listen to Junior. Listen to Roger. Listen to the considered opinions of practitioners and mental health and medical health associations that have consistently warned us about the dangers of this practice. Please support the Mental Health Protections Act and protect vulnerable Minnesotans and their parents from abuse and deception. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. So we have about 10 minutes left for supporters of this bill. So if there's anyone in the audience who is a supporter of this bill and would like to testify, please come down. Please come. Please introduce yourself.
Chairwoman, members of the committee, my name is Johann Baumeister.
Please proceed.
My story starts much the same way as the survivors, the brave survivors behind me who shared their stories. I think my story is actually illustrative of the benefit of this bill, though. I grew up in a bubble that was filled with messages of, well, that I was broken, that people like me were condemned, that they would die of AIDS, that there was no good outcome and no positive future for them. It is only by a series of small but significant miracles that I found a mere handful of people who told me that that was a lie on my journey. Those people prepared me, gave me the strength to see what horror might await me should I come out as an underage person with few legal rights to protect myself from this therapy. Those folks told me that God doesn't make a mistake when he creates people. Those folks shared with me their concern for my safety should I come out at an age under 18. And so I took their advice, and I waited. I still bear the scars of the day I came out, but those scars were not magnified by this dangerous therapy. Those scars were not magnified by the trauma that would have been inflicted upon me, because the day I came out, my parents insisted that I go into reparative therapy. I was given the strength to say no. As a child, many Minnesotans don't have that ability. You have to protect them. There is no other moral course here.
Thank you so much. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My turn?
Yes.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Margaret Charmley. I'm a past president of the Minnesota Psychological Association and a former member of the American Psychological Association Council of Representatives. I'm a licensed psychologist in the state of Minnesota, and I've taught graduate-level courses at universities about appropriate therapeutic interventions for working with gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer individuals. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Psychological Association to support the passage of this bill. I want to make several points about why we are supporting this bill. First of all, conversion therapy and its correlates are based on the premise that same-sex attractions and romantic desires are signs of a mental disorder. By 1974, both the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association concluded that homosexuality is not a psychological or developmental disorder. They based their decisions on a substantial body of scientific research that refuted erroneous beliefs that it was. This then begs the question, 45 years later, about conversion therapy. If something isn't broken, broken, why are some people trying to fix it? Number two, the American Psychological Association Task Force, charged with reviewing scientific research on efforts to change sexual orientation, found that efforts to change sexual orientation are unlikely to be successful and have been associated with harmful effects. These harmful effects include depression, distress, shame, guilt, social withdrawal, suicidality, increased substance use, high-risk sexual behaviors, increased self-hatred, and negative perceptions about same-sex attractions. I ask you, would you or any of your family members want to expose yourself to psychotherapy or therapy that leaves you feeling this way? The findings of the American Psychological Task Force on Appropriate Therapeutic Responses to Sexual Orientation prompted the APA to adopt resolutions regarding efforts to change sexual orientation. Two of these are as follows. APA encourages mental health professionals to avoid misrepresenting the efficacy of sexual orientation change efforts by promoting or promising change in sexual orientation when providing assistance to individuals distressed by their own or other sexual orientation. APA advises parents, guardians, young people, and their families to avoid sexual orientation change efforts that portray homosexuality as a mental illness or developmental disorder. Those recommendations were based on an exhaustive, systematic review of the reputable scientific literature that looked at over 83 studies that had been done on sexual orientation change efforts, and those are the conclusions that they came to. I happen to have been a member of the American Psychological Association Council of Representatives when we reviewed and adopted that task force finding. Finally, appropriate therapeutic responses to people who experience distress related to their sexual orientation recognize that this distress is not related to sexual orientation per se, but is probably due to being a member of a marginalized and stigmatized group that is forced to deal with prejudice, discrimination, and family rejection. The remedy for this distress is not to try and change sexual orientation. The remedy for this distress is to offer affirmative, multiculturally competent approaches that help people understand stress, develop positive coping skills, nurture resilience, seek social support, and get accurate information about sexual orientation and same-sex relationships.
Thank you.
These approaches have been shown to be effective, evidence-based practices that are associated with positive outcomes in therapy. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much. So this will have to be our last testifier. We have about 3 minutes left. 1 minute?
I'll keep it brief.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Committee, thank you for allowing us to be here today. My name is Ryan Wines. I'm a resident of St. Paul. While I am a gay Catholic conservative, which is a whole other topic, I hold a psychology degree from St. Thomas, but I'm not here as anyone speaking in the psychological or medical field, and I am a practicing Catholic, but I'm not here speaking as any clergy. I'm here representing the business community of the Twin Cities, specifically the LGBTQ business community, Quorum, the LGBT Chamber of Commerce, and I preside over the National Association of Gay and Lesbian Real Estate Professionals. I'm here to leverage our support as taxpayers in the state of Minnesota for Hunter's bill in hopes that, and I can't believe I'm saying this, we take what Paul Wellstone said before he left. We all do better when we all do better. I would urge you, even if you don't have a personal root or a personal connection to this legislation, to think about the impacts that it has on the greater community. That includes the business community. So thank you for your time. I told you I'd keep it short.
All right. Thank you so much for your testimony. So we have some scheduled opposition to this bill. We have about 17 testifiers. So, again, you know, as you come down, try to be as concise as you can. And please remember you have others behind you who also like to speak. Renee Carson, Robert Roby.
The pages will pass.
Okay. Okay, Ms. Carson, please introduce yourself for the record, and you can begin your testimony. Please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Renee Carlson. I'm here as an attorney on behalf of the North Star Law and Policy Center. It's an alliance of attorneys across the state of Minnesota. This bill restricts various types of counseling and therapy, infringing upon the constitutionally protected rights of Minnesotans, which is why we oppose this bill. First, this bill censors constitutionally protected speech by licensed counselors, clients, and others based on content and viewpoint. It bans speech that helps a person address unwanted same-sex attractions, but specifically allows for speech that helps someone embrace such attractions. Our Supreme Court has held that the government may not legally censor speech because of the viewpoint the speech represents. Quote, government action that stifles speech on account of its message possesses the inherent risk that the government seeks not to advance a legitimate regulatory goal, but to suppress unpopular ideas or information. The Supreme Court has also informed us that professional speech is not deserving of any less protection under the U.S. Constitution, and even recently, specifically mentioned, two lower courts had erroneously held that counseling speech was afforded lesser constitutional protections in cases specifically involving so-called conversion therapy ban bills. Just 2 weeks ago, a magistrate judge relied on this precedent in recommending a similar law in Tampa, Florida, be enjoined because the plaintiffs established a likelihood of success on the merits based on their First Amendment speech claims. It's been stated today that there are a number of medical associations that are in favor of this bill. But there are also those here today who oppose this bill, and for various reasons. And it is not the job of a medical association or the government to take away the free speech rights of Minnesotans in this state. If enacted, House File 12 opens the door to a plethora of legal challenges. Also concerning is this bill's vague and entirely subjective language. It lacks clear guidelines about what conversations, resources, and messages are permitted under law. This leaves counselors, clients, and all others expected to comply with the prohibitions confused about what the prohibitions actually are, which is inconsistent with the First Amendment's protections against ambiguity and chilling of protected speech. These reasons alone demonstrate how the language in House File 12 impermissibly infringes upon the First Amendment rights of Minnesota, and that is a precious right that the members of this committee should vouch to protect. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, Robert Roby and Reverend Hines. Please introduce.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a mediator, so I've been listening to all the testimony. And
can you please repeat your name for the record?
Robert Roby, R-O-B-Y.
Thank you.
As a mediator by profession, I've been listening to the testimony, and it's been very, very informative and very helpful. I came today out of concern, and I'll make my background clear as to where I'm coming from, but over the past 36 years, I've been a youth worker, a guardian ad litem, worked with families. My primary occupation as a licensed attorney the last 26 years, not a doctor, but I have a Juris Doctorate, but I'm a Rule 114 qualified neutral, and I mediate about 75 to 100 cases a year involving families in conflict. My concern over this bill is its impact on the increasing number of children in Minnesota today who are end up needing therapy or some kind of mental health work to be done. The durability of relationships is at an all-time crisis level right now. Children go through so many transitions, more than ever in our history. Stability is a rare thing, and kids are being affected by this. And the mental health profession is trying to step in and help kids through these crises in their lives. I'm concerned about the amount of forethought that it appears may not have been given to this bill. Just a little more about my background. I've been involved primarily in the last 8 years. Most of the mediation I do is as an evaluative neutral. So I evaluate cases. I talk to parties about what a court probably will do, what the possible outcomes would be, and try to come to some agreements. I've done probably 750 cases over the past 8 years. I also serve as a parent custody and parenting time evaluator, a parenting time expediter, and I serve as an administrative hearing officer in three cities in Minnesota. I'm a member of the Bar Association. I'm on the ADR Council. I serve on the Diversity Inclusion Committee. I provided legal representation for therapists and mental health providers in the past, a number of nonprofit organizations. I'm aware of the rationale behind this bill, and I understand what it's trying to prevent. The first question that came to my mind is, why is this not being brought into the rulemaking process? The Board of Psychology has rulemaking powers. They govern what conduct, what best practices are, what mental health professionals, what their code of conduct is, how they should handle things. If this were aimed at malpractice issues, then I would think that that's where this would be brought. I also think that there would have been think twice about using a term that is loaded with political undertones. Conversion is a word that came out of, religious background, religious tradition, rather than what we're talking about, I think, is coercion therapy. Okay, that overrides the person's wishes, that's not recognizing where they are now. I understand that the harm, and nobody should be subjected to the kinds of psychological harm and abuse that people have shared today. I that should not happen. But this bill is aimed far broader than at those professional situations. I'm also concerned about the zone of privacy between a mental health professional and their patient, that a statute should reach in and try to dictate what they can and can't do to treat their patient. I don't think we're qualified to do that, honestly, by statute. Now, under the rulemaking of the Board of Psychology, best practices, what's effective, what really brings about healing, those things should be guiding those rules. But this is a statute that has a much broader target than the mental health profession. That concerns me. It seems that overreach is going on here, and I don't think the backlash that I'm concerned about when it overreaches its legitimate target is that the backlash could cause more pain and more lawsuits and more stress and more negative consequences to the very kids and families we're trying to protect here. This should be targeted. This should be a surgery, not a sledgehammer in a china shop. I think it's overbroad.
Okay. We have...
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate it. Please introduce yourself. And can we have Carl Nelson come down, please?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, first of all, I'm unable to be here for this evening's session, so if you have questions. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts concerning House File 12. My name is Reverend Frederick Hintz. I serve as the public policy advocate for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and its roughly 180,000 members across the state of Minnesota. I have come to express a strong opposition to this bill. The reasons for our opposition are many, varied, and deeply felt. I'd like to discuss just two of them today. First of all, we believe this bill represents a rather blatant disregard for the free speech rights, not just of professional counselors, but for all Minnesotans. By arbitrarily singling out this one topic from the many that might motivate a client to seek help from a professional counselor, and limiting the type of advice that that professional counselor might offer goes far beyond the calling and the competence of government. Indeed, in so doing, the state would be violating both the right of the client to self-determination, that is, the right to set their own therapeutic goals, as well as the right of the counselor to offer his or her best, most well-considered advice, as they have a fiduciary responsibility to do. In short, when there are no third-party interests to be considered, as is the case here, it is simply inappropriate for the state to insert itself in the relationship of the counselor and client. Secondly, since matters of human sexuality are intimately connected with a person's religious beliefs, for the state to choose and to seek to enforce a correct or incorrect view of sexuality is a gross violation of the state's constitutional obligation to remain neutral in matters of religious belief. Indeed, for the state to choose an official view of what it what it is to be a human being and how we should express our sexuality is nothing less than an effort to establish an official state church. That the state should not and may not do. Indeed, one of the most fundamental and cherished freedoms that we enjoy as Americans is the right to follow the dictates of our own conscience, the right to determine what is in our own best interest, and to seek the help of others in pursuing that best interest. In attempting to set limits on what those best interests might be and prohibiting others from helping us to pursue those interests, we have here clearly a form of coercion that the government is not warranted to engage in and should cause all of us to recoil from. Members of the committee, I urge you not to pass this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions for this testifier? Because he would not be around this afternoon, this evening. Okay. Carnelson, David Kirby? Okay, and in the meantime, Mr. Nelson, could you introduce yourself and proceed? Right.
Yeah, good afternoon, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. My name is Carl Nelson. I am a president of Transform Minnesota. Transform Minnesota is a regional network of churches, and a key part of our mission is to provide training to pastors and church leaders to equip them as they serve their congregations. As a church network, we oppose this bill because it's broadly written, and it does not specifically address conversion therapy practices that have been shown to be harmful, such as those that we've heard earlier today from survivors. Serving as a network of churches and communities all across Minnesota, we're aware that Christians frequently seek spiritual help and professional counsel to address a whole range of sexual behaviors and feelings that they may be trying to align with the teachings of their faith. One of the tenets of the Christian faith is that change is possible. Some people do want to change their feelings of same-sex attraction or to identify with their biological sex. The people who make this choice because of their religious beliefs should have the right to choose the kind of counseling that they determine will best hurt them, help them. But in fact, this bill actually discriminates against those who have same-sex attraction or who are experiencing a degree of gender confusion, who because of their religious beliefs want to change and seek out professional counseling to support the behavior change that they are trying to make. Certainly, we would agree that abusive or coercive and unproven counseling techniques should not be allowed. And if this bill were addressing those specific practices that have been shown to be harmful, we'd certainly support that. As a church network, we also often provide teaching conferences that pastors sometimes pay a fee to attend. And some of the conferences that offer religious teaching talk about the possibility of reorienting one's sexual desires. And the advertisement and sales clause of this bill is so broadly written that even a faith-based organization like ours would have to discontinue the religious training that we are providing to our pastors. Religious freedom is a founding principle of this nation, and the state should not intrude or prohibit a person from pursuing the kind of counseling that they believe would help them make the kind of life changes that they desire that are based upon their religious beliefs. And so I would urge the members of this committee to vote no on this bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Can we get the next testifier to introduce yourself and call down Nate Olo?
Yes. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Dave Kirby, and I'm a licensed doctoral-level clinical psychologist in Minnesota, and I oppose House File 12. And I have five reasons here, quick ones. Number one, I am disappointed that the term conversion therapy is used to describe all therapy that is not gay-affirming. This term reeks with highly negative connotations from its use, especially in the 1970s, to change various behaviors in clients through aversive, sometimes abusive techniques. I think at one point ice pick lobotomies were performed, shock therapy, things of that nature. So conversion therapy has a highly pejorative connotation to it. This term has no place in the current practice of responsible therapy. And so it is highly misleading when the first words of this bill link counseling people to an outdated aversive reprogramming that at best is unscientific. I agree with that. Secondly, the psychologist's role is to listen non-judgmentally and with care to clients, whether children or adults, to understand how they want to grow and then to facilitate this growth. Ironically, HF12 insists that there's only one treatment goal for clients, thus dictating the direction of therapy and rendering unbiased objective care impossible. Restricting clients' choices also dictates to therapists that they must neglect the critical role that sexual abuse experienced as a child and other intervening social factors may play in the journey toward a healthy sexual identity. Thirdly, this bill is superfluous because every licensed mental health practitioner is already accountable to the authority of a board that demands ethical and professional treatment of the client. Fourthly, I guess a question that I will get the answer to later, is it true that if this bill does pass, is it scheduled to take effect very quickly? If this is true, apparently therapists who are currently working with clients who are personally dedicated to working through unwanted SSA would be compelled to immediately cease and desist therapy with these clients. This abrupt cessation of therapy is tantamount to abandonment of the client, something that the Minnesota Board of Psychology highly discourages in our work as a basic ethical tenet. Lastly, this bill appears driven by a desire to provide unbiased therapy to individuals in a spirit of tolerance and respect. Unfortunately, this tolerance and respect seems to apply only to specified clients and discriminates against a minority that desires to strive toward heterosexuality. The spirit of intolerance in this bill is surprising, and the dictation of client goals is a clear violation of the freedom of speech at best and a practice bordering on coercion at worst. These objectives seem more in harmony with the very conversion therapy that this bill condemns. And so my last thought is that there seem to be two points in this bill. One is that conversion therapy that's aversive and abusive should be banned. I don't think that from everything I've heard that I'm opposed to that. I am opposed when any treatment that a client wishes to pursue that might support ego-dystonic homosexuality, that should not be allowed to be conducted. That is a violation of freedom of speech. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
representatives.
Thank you. So please introduce yourself. I'm going to call down John Redmond.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Nathan Oilo, and I oppose this bill.
Let's remember to be concise. All right, thank you.
As an adolescent, I experienced same-sex attractions knowing that homosexual practice was inconsistent with my religious faith, I chose to explore my options with the help of qualified mental health professionals and pastoral caregivers. I was not forced. I was not coerced. I was not abused. In fact, I was honored and loved in that I was given the power of choice and the dignity to think for myself. In choosing to live now as a heterosexual man, I in no way feel repressed or unfulfilled sexually. In fact, just the opposite. I've been happily married for 14 years, and I'm the proud father of three beautiful children, none of which would have been possible if I had not had the freedom to choose my own counseling objectives. Furthermore, as a pastor, I've worked with many young people over the past 20 years who were questioning their sexual orientation or gender identity and who were, like me, wanting to bring their sexual orientation and gender identity into agreement with their faith. These young people were given the same love, honor, and dignity afforded me in my youth, the power of choice, and the dignity to think for themselves. If a young person didn't want to meet with me, they were blessed and released. It is not the place of Minnesota legislators to hinder the Church of Minnesota from providing information and care to people who are questioning their sexual orientation and gender identity. There are many in this state who desire the input of their faith communities so to make well-informed, wise choices regarding how they navigate their same-sex attractions or gender dysphoria in a way that honors their religious faith. To take away their power of choice and their right to information is by definition abuse. I now work with people coming out of trauma and abuse, and I know how important it is to make sure the individual is in charge of his or her counseling goals. Please do not take away the yes or the no of questioning youth. If I were to write a book about my experience encouraging others to pursue a particular path like mine and wanted to sell it, under this bill, it is my understanding that I could be prosecuted for consumer fraud if it was interpreted as promoting conversion therapy. Do not hinder my freedom of speech by making it illegal to tell my story. Do not take away my place in Minnesota society by rendering my story fraudulent. Thank you.
Thank you so much. So we have about 20 minutes left in this hearing. I want you to proceed. Introduce yourself and Jeremy Dahlin. Dahlin, you come down, please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and representatives. My name is John Rettman. My story began when I was an adolescent, probably 13 or 14 years old. I realized that I was sexually attracted to men and that my life going forward would be different than most of my peers. You see, I have been a devout Christian since I was able to understand who Jesus was and what he did for me. I believe that God made me, knew my situation, and knew what was best. My Christian faith tells me that God intended for sex to be shared between a married husband and wife, and that other sexual actions are not holy. I love Jesus more than I love my own desires, so I chose to pursue a heterosexual lifestyle. A couple years passed, and I was 15. My family had undergone some difficult life events, and my parents offered me the opportunity to see a Christian psychologist here in Minnesota. My sexuality was not the reason that my parents offered, nor was it the reason I decided to see my counselor for the first time. But once he gained my trust, I told him about my attraction to men and asked him to help me live according to my Christian faith. My psychologist received this information kindly, telling me that he had worked with many other men like me and told me that there was hope and that my goals were good and attainable. He also told me that he didn't want me to obsess or worry about my attractions because having the attractions themselves was not wrong. Over the years, my experiences with this Christian therapist have been nothing short of life-saving. In high school, I experienced a major depressive episode, which I believe was triggered by my intense academic schedule. Since then, I continued to grow and learn how to cope with life's challenges, including my same-sex attraction. I am so thankful for the support I was legally able to receive from my psychologist in living out a heterosexual Christian lifestyle, despite my attraction toward men, even while I was still a minor. Everyone should have the opportunity, like I did, to set their own counseling goals. Please oppose this bill and allow other people like me to pursue the counseling that they feel is right for them. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay, please introduce yourself and Chris Morbitzer.
Hello, my name is Jeremy Dolan, Madam Chair, members of this committee. I also just wanted to say I will not be available for questions later. I was never in coercive therapy. Like many of the victims that you've heard of today, I'm thankful for that, and I believe that that is utterly wrong. I was confused and saddened when I heard about this bill, and here's why. Growing up, I questioned my sexuality like many do. My parents chose a counselor for me who helped me realize it was okay to talk about what was going on inside my head out loud. Later in life, I chose my own counselors. I explored my sexuality and was supported by many in my choice to pursue heterosexual-based counseling. I am now a very happy, fulfilled man, married to a beautiful woman and the father of three beautiful children. My extremely joyful life that I lead today literally relates to all of the things that HF12 would suppress. And in short, here's what that is. My ability to choose what I wanted with my life. No one should do that for me. It seems strange that it's 2019 and we're trying to limit the choices, the services, the mental health and counseling options for people. We live in a day of diversity and inclusion. We need to include all of the voices in our state. Inclusivity truly means making every single voice heard. We need to include all of the voices, especially the quiet or marginalized ones. This bill would have taken away my voice and my choice as a young person, ultimately taking away the life that I live today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. I'll pay you Dorothy. Dorothy, come down, please, and go ahead, introduce yourself, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Committee. My name is Chris Morbitzer. I'm a resident of St. Paul, and I oppose this bill. When I was in middle school, I also began to experience sexual attraction to the other boys. I had many questions because of that about where I belonged, about what I felt and what I believed, and like many at this age, I began to form my own identity. This included interests in music and sciences, faith in God, and a desire one day to have a wife and children. And I chose my identity, and that was more important to me than anything in its way. And so I tried with all of my own willpower to make my same-sex attractions go away. And it's not surprising to anyone in this room, it didn't work. So for many years, I couldn't stop, and they became stronger, and I began to engage in sexual behavior with some of my peers. And each time I did, I anticipated that I would feel fulfilled and connected. But instead, for me, after each occurrence, I felt emptier and farther away from the path I wanted for my own life, and I began to lose hope. And so I chose to see a licensed professional counselor. Our sessions were consistent with modern evidence-based therapy. We discussed the nature of shame and addiction, my behaviors, and my own desire to live consistently with the beliefs and choices that I had chosen for myself. My time in therapy was transformational. I found that with professional help, I could change my behaviors. Therapy reduced my shame. It reduced my fear and anxiety and my same-sex attractions. This all occurred in an atmosphere of unconditional care, gentleness, and compassion. Today, my life is radically different than it was when I was in high school. I no longer desire to have sex with other men. I'm happily married to my incredibly beautiful wife. I feel more alive than I ever have before. I don't wish to change who I am in order to pursue a gay lifestyle. I found hope and happiness because I chose to change my unwanted sexual behavior and had the opportunity to find help. My life, my story is possible because I made a free choice, and my counselor had the freedom to affirm me and encourage me in my own journey. The proposed bill before us would make my story illegal. It would snuff out my story in future generations and declare in a loud voice that I and others like me are not welcome in Minnesota. It would remove the freedom of licensed therapists who are already ethically committed to a high standard of care from helping clients follow their dreams. There are young men and women today who experience same-sex attractions and want to pursue a different path than what mainstream culture declares them must follow. This would deny them the opportunity to realize a life of their own choosing. We have made lives of our choosing because we received qualified, ethical, compassionate, and evidence-based care that supported our choices. Please oppose this bill and let us know that our stories matter, too, in Minnesota. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Jamie Maxey, and please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members. My name is Peggy Doherty, and I'm asking you today to oppose House File 12. I lived in same-sex relationships for 18 years of my life and was in therapy on and off that entire time. I struggled with depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts, which is what I took medication for. When I was looking for a therapist, and I saw many, I wanted one that would encourage me and empower me, someone that would help me to wrestle with my thoughts and my fears. I was not looking for someone to change me, but someone would help me, that would help me to know myself. Over the years, I found a lesbian therapist who changed my life. She didn't push an agenda. She didn't tell me I was a lesbian because I had same-sex attraction. Instead, she talked to me about my struggle with unwanted same-sex, and she let me talk about it freely. She allowed me to ask questions, and she helped me to dig deep into how my life experiences were affecting my thoughts and feelings. My therapist had the freedom. She had the freedom to allow me to set my own goals, and that's why I no longer identify as a lesbian today. I no longer take medication for depression or anxiety, and I live a very full, busy, and satisfying life. House File 12 would put a political agenda ahead of people like me and remove those choices for them. We live in a culture today that allows men and women to change their bodies based on the gender they identify with. Why shouldn't we be allowed to change our mind? Please vote no on this bill. Our kids deserve it. Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And thank you so much. Can we get Luca Bopoli down? And please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman. My name is Jamie Maxey, and I oppose this bill. I am a St. Paul resident. My story kind of began at age 12, when I started to explore my sexuality. At the time, I had nobody to talk to. I spent hours on Google typing in, how do you know if you're a lesbian? One day, a few years later, I heard from a friend who had come out of the homosexual lifestyle. I was ready to fight her because, according to Google, I was born this way. And I know that the homosexual lifestyle wasn't something that you could just up and walk out of. After hearing her story and sharing my story of coming out of sexual abuse and the fear of men and the reason why I chose to be gay, she showed me nothing but love. Just her response with all that just left me longing for something more, something that was real. If it wasn't for that response, I would still be trapped in a whirlwind of depression, of suicidal thoughts, of just being full of hate. Now I'm glad to say that I'm out of the homosexual lifestyle, and I'm walking in my freedom. I'm learning what my true identity from God really is. And although healing has been a long journey, I have such an amazing community by my side who are there to lift me up when I'm feeling down, confused, or hurt. If it wasn't for my church and for my small groups that I am a part of, I wouldn't be where I am today. When I hear the word conversion therapy, I see a phrase that has been twisted by fear. Trust me, a few years ago, I would have been in the same boat as I'm sure most people are. This is scary. What are they going to do? Are they going to shock the gay out of me? If they're going to shock the gay out of me, that's terrifying. But a thing to remember is you're in the driver's seat when it comes to therapy. You have the ability to say yes or no, and you, and there are laws in place to protect people from unfair treatment. And for those of you who have gone through conversion therapy and who have been abused, I personally want to apologize because that's not right. It shouldn't even be called conversion therapy. It should just be called therapy. A person can openly choose whether he or she wants to. If this bill is passed here, you aren't protecting people. You aren't preventing the kids from committing suicide. You're taking away a person's ability to talk to a safe person about questions they may have. I know personally, if it wasn't for meeting with my counselor weekly, I would be so full of questions and just so lost in this journey. You're trapping a kid who's in the closet questioning whether or not they're gay and causing them to feel alone and isolated, questioning whether or not this is the path that they should follow. You're taking away a person's freedom to choose, to get help, to seek out something else other than the lies that they're trapped in. You're cutting off a person's support who's participating in small groups, trying to make sense of this all. And simply, you're saying a person has no choice to seek help. You're taking away a person's story. You're causing fear because what happens if that person's going to share their story? Are they going to end up in jail with this bill being passed? If you approve this bill, you're giving a person who is walking out of the homosexual lifestyle, you aren't giving them any options. You're trapping them in a place where they feel alone and can't talk to anybody, and just like how it was when they were in the closet. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We're doing pretty good here. We have a few more testifiers. A few has waived their testimony because they have submitted a written document to us. So with Luca here and Gerald Dolls, please come down.
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much for allowing me to speak today. I think this is a very big matter that's going on, and it's good that we can be here together. I spent over 30 years in the gay and lesbian lifestyle. I was transsexual. My family took me to the University of Minnesota to the Program of Human Sexuality, where I received help after I already had been sexually molested by a family member for several years, and came to the wrong conclusion that being a girl.
One second. Could you please reintroduce yourself?
I'm sorry?
I think you did. Introduce yourself again. Can you say your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. Luca Joe Grappoli.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Sorry about that.
Very much. So, So after spending over 30 years in the lifestyle, they took me to the program in human sexuality. I had been sexually molested as a child by a family member and his friends for several years, and it was absolutely horrific. I remember one day in particular where him and his friends were having their way with me. I was laying on the floor, and something happened to me that day. There was a break in my soul, and there was like a separation of who I was. I didn't even know how to function beyond that day. It's like I went into this photograph that was on the wall because it all became too much for me. I didn't know how to live anymore. And I recall after that day, I called and I'd asked my sisters, I said, "Do you see me?" I said, do you feel me? Am I really here?" And I didn't know what was going on, and it was absolutely horrifying. And I remember feeling like I was trapped in this dream of not knowing who I was or where I was or how to get out, but nobody would notice that something was really wrong with me. When somebody finally did take me to the program in human sexuality and they told me that I have a gender dysphoria, and I said, "Well, what is that?" And they explained it to me, and And they said, I said, what are my options? And they said, you can have sex change or you can commit suicide. That's usually what happens with people in my condition. And I thought, well, I hated myself for responding to my brothers touching me. So being a girl wasn't good for me. So the thought of being a boy was an absolute wonderful solution. So I said, let's do the sex change. And I went down that road of getting involved. I had my name changed legally, and I never went any further with the assessment. I didn't go on the hormones. I didn't go to the surgery. Because all the time that this was going on, all the trauma was going on, there was something in me that always said, something's not right, Luca. There's something not right. And I didn't know what that was, but I suppressed it, and I didn't want to hear it. I'm like, I don't want to know that. If I'm wrong about this, what else could I be wrong about? I was horrified to even think about dealing with that little girl that was traumatized. Okay? So when I was 46 years old, I met a woman. I fell in love with her, and she told me that if I was going to live with her, that I needed to go to church. And to me, it just meant keeping the girl. I didn't care about God. I didn't really know about God. And so I went to church, and that day I went, something happened in me, and I met this God whom I didn't even care about or believe in. But when he came into my heart, there was like this, it was like my heart was the size of a pea, and his love was this ocean, and it flooded every ounce of me. And there was so much love that I never had as a child growing up, that all of a sudden, oh my God, what is this love? And the more he kept loving me, the more I kept opening my heart to him, I kept hearing this pastor saying that God loves me no matter what, no matter who I am. He loves me and cares about me. And I kept opening my heart to him, thinking, could this really be true? Could somebody really love me the way I've never had love before? And I thought, I got to find out. And then all of a sudden I read the scripture that said, where Jesus said, he who holds on to his life will lose it, and he who loses it for my sake will find it. And I realized that if I really was going to go anywhere in life, that I had to give myself to the Lord. And once that happened, there was a major shift in me. Something changed in my heart the more God loved me. The more he loved me, the more that everything else over there was not of importance to me anymore. I loved God. And he loved me, and in that, all of that healing, all of that self-hatred, all that self-denial, all of a sudden, it wasn't there anymore. That injured, scared, traumatized little girl, no more. I felt complete, I felt whole, and I don't have to deal with same-sex attraction anymore. I'm attracted to men, and if the Lord finds me a husband, hot diggity. Amen? My desire will be that people will still have the right to choose. It's yeah. Horrible what happened to people that are in the lifestyle that they were traumatized. That shouldn't be. And I feel really sorry for the people that have been hurt, for any of us that have been hurt. But what's even sadder is that if someone chooses homosexuality, that's their choice, right? We shouldn't tell people they can't be something. If you're homosexual, then you're homosexual. Okay? But if I want to go to therapy and find out, then I should be allowed that. And I did go to therapy, and I actually loved it. I stuck with it for 7 years. I liked it so much. So, and that was when I was still gay. So thank you so much for hearing me.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your testimony, sharing your story.
Gerard. Hi, my name is Chaplain Gerard Doles.
This will be our last testimony, you guys. And after this, we're going to have to recess and come back. We have Dan Pumala, and I think Daryl Napkin. Those will be the last two. So I want you to go ahead, and I'm hoping you can come back this evening to testify. So please proceed.
Okay, and I won't be here after this.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Again, my name is Chaplain Gerard Doles. It is a privilege as a native son of Minnesota to stand before you today as a former homosexual who found an ultimate health, hope, and healing through the transformation power of faith, encouragement of faithful friends, and supportive professionals. I urge you to oppose the House File 12. This legislation will destroy the most fundamental freedom of all religion, liberty, conscience, and the rights of individuals to pursue happiness for themselves. In the 1970s, I was introduced to Harvey Milk by Don Amador at Cal University. We became good friends. long before his life was made iconic. He was the man that was murdered in San Francisco. He was the city commissioner of San Francisco. The mayor of San Francisco, Mayor Moscone, was killed with him the same day. Before his icon by the movie regarding his advocacy for the LGBT community, he knew a younger me. There's actually a scene in the movie that shows a phone call with a young man in Minnesota. And that call was to me. I once identified as a gay, but now I find happiness and wholeness in the Christian lifestyle. I'm particularly concerned about the language of the bill that prohibits this counseling for vulnerable adults. That is me. This bill takes away options for people like me. I and other like me have a constitutional right to choose our path, and this bill completely takes away the right. By including vulnerable adults, I was born disabled, by the way, that's my wheelchair. I do walk sometimes, but I have deformed legs. By including vulnerable adults, the true motive of this bill revealed it is not about protecting kids, it's about taking away options from adults to pursue the counseling that they want and need. I had the opportunity to set the counseling goals I wanted. Please keep that option open for other people like me. Closing, 40 years ago this coming March, I've given my life to the Lord. I was living in Hollywood. I was very empty. I needed someone to save my life. I was so empty and hurt. I didn't want to become straight, per se, even though my desire is to know somebody that could change my life and make me a brand new person. And the day that I accepted Jesus, he made me a brand new person inside. If you knew me before I got saved, I was really evil, wicked, and mean to people. But when Jesus came into my life, he changed me. And so I ask you, please vote no on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Real quick, members, do you have a question? Because this testifier would not be back this afternoon. And if not, we're going to break to the call of the chair. We're thinking that we should be back maybe around 5:30, 6 o'clock. For those of you who are in the audience, if you'd like to stay in this room until that time, you're welcome with the sergeant of arms here who's going to make sure you're in a safe space to do that. Other than that, we are adjourned into we are in recess into the call of the chair. Yes.
I'd like to call the Health and Human Services Policy Committee back to order. Chair Moran had to step away, so as Vice Chair, I'll be presiding over the meeting. We've spoken with advocates from both sides, and we've decided to conclude testimony. And so we'll proceed with questions from committee members. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a question for our author, Representative Hunter Cantrell. We heard a little bit today about freedom of speech, and I was wondering if you had a chance to talk to people on the freedom of speech issue that has been raised, and also about what are the limits for healthcare providers when it comes to the freedom of speech issue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Fisher. I have spoken with experts on the freedom of speech and the freedom of religion, and we have concluded that this bill in no way inhibits the freedom of speech or the exercise of religion. There is well-documented legal phenomena, legal jurisprudence, that one's freedom of speech and one's freedom of expression of religion ends at when it begins to harm another individual or individuals. So we have thoroughly explored that, and we have found that this bill does not infringe on those essential liberties. And I have with me today Mr. Ben Feist from the ACLU, if there are any other questions related to the freedom of expression and the freedom of religion and how this bill in no way infringes on those essential liberties.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And also, as you're mentioning that, the freedom of expression in terms of religion, et cetera, but also when it gets into the medical field, how does that apply for a physician or a mental health practitioner? Are they limited as to what they're able to say when you're mentioning about when it does harm to another person?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Fisher. Medical practitioners and mental health practitioners are required to abide by the prescribed standards of care and overall by the principle of doing no harm. So when we consider that is the basis for sound ethical medical practice in our country, we know that when anything, whether it is a therapeutic treatment, a talk therapy, an idea or opinion from a practitioner, if that threatens the health, well-being, and overall mental stability of a patient, we know that that is not ethical conduct from medical practitioners and mental health practitioners. So that is where we as a society have said this is what we outline is acceptable practice for mental health and medical practitioners.
Thank you. Are there other questions from committee members? Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cottrell, thank you so much for presenting this bill today. I myself have been a therapist, and I think that the ban on this that you're proposing is actually a reasonable one. And we heard a lot of testimony here today because, like you said, as clinicians, we take an oath to make sure that we're not doing harm. I think from a lot of the testifiers that you brought here today, we can see that there is harm. Conversion therapies honestly undermines the practice of therapy, undermines trust. One of your testifiers said it's mental health malpractice. I would agree with that. The one thing, actually, I would like to call up Ben Feist from the ACLU, if you wouldn't mind.
Please identify yourself again for the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. Could you speak? There was some question about constitutionality. Could you speak to that a little bit from your opinion as an ACLU attorney?
Madam Chair, Representative Edelson, yes, I can speak to that at least in general. Mm-hmm. So we have looked at these types of bills throughout the country, and generally speaking, when it is limited to licensed practitioners, these really don't raise free speech concerns. And this bill, I think, is very narrowly tailored to address the unsafe and discriminatory practices of conversion therapy.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. I would also just note that, I heard with all the testifiers and opposed to this, and I do, their testimony was appreciated. There's not a place for legislators in this, is what I heard, that legislators are overstepping their territory. But one would also say that when we allow same-sex marriage, we overstepped our territory. When we deal with desegregation of schools, that we overstepped our territory. So looking at these things, members, is why the public put us here.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. Any further comments or questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Representative Cantrell. I appreciate this conversation. In a number of the testifiers' comments, they shared horrific stories. No one should have to suffer at the hands of practitioners, those type of ordeals. I think we're all in agreement on that. I did find it curious, and I'm looking for your comment. I think it was Mr. Roby from Minnesota Mediation Services, who, given his certification as a neutrality neutral partner to this, made the comment that why wouldn't this type of a situation where professional boards are already observing a non-practice of these types of things, why wouldn't it be more appropriately handled through the rulemaking authority of those boards?
Madam Chair, Representative Albright.
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you. Thank you for that question. You know, I think what is really critical about this bill is that we are codifying into law that this is a practice that is not tolerable. Rulemaking authorities are outside of the jurisdiction of the legislature, and we as legislators, I believe, are charged with rulemaking that is something fundamental and foundational within our state. So to establish within law parameters around this practice, around this mental health malpractice, is a definitive statement that this is something we will no longer tolerate. And when that is an agreement with rulemaking authorities, that is fantastic. I think we as a legislature need to also affirm where the law stands on this.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you. Representative Cantrell, we authorize boards with rulemaking authority, and so it is under our purview. So to the extent that we would require boards to undergo rulemaking authority for that, we are interceding on behalf of the people that have been have suffered at the hands of these situations. In another testimony, particularly from Mr. Avalos, he shared with us just a very a tremendous testimony. But I noted that he went to Texas for his first experience, understandably it was tragic, then traveled to Philadelphia, came back to Minnesota. But I'm just wondering, in the context of the witnesses, I didn't hear specific names of any clinics in the state of Minnesota that are practicing this type of aberrant behavior. And I'm just wondering, if that is in fact happening, why isn't it being brought to the attention of the regulating board that they are a member of?
Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, it's difficult to quantify, and it is difficult sometimes, actually oftentimes, to know who exactly, as clinicians, which clinics in particular, are providing conversion therapy services. Oftentimes, these services might be provided under a different specification, under a guise or a ruse, or oftentimes not widely advertised. What we do know is that this practice is still widespread in Minnesota, and what we want to do is to make sure that no more children are harmed.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, if in fact that statement, and I have no reason to doubt you, is happening, why haven't there been police reports or legal action taken against those people on behalf of the people that have suffered at the hands of these clinicians?
Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, because it is not yet illegal.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Representative Cantrell, each one of the boards that was cited in the beginning of the testimony says in their code of conduct that this activity is not legal. So I would take exception with the fact that it isn't illegal yet. And from the standpoint of if legality is a question, why hasn't there been any professional action taken within the context of those testifiers and those actions? Has there been action taken by the professional boards for those individuals who have practiced this?
Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I do not know about specific board proceedings pertaining to specific practitioners in this regard.
Madam Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you for indulging me.
One more.
We heard a lot about the concept the statement made by some testifiers in terms of right to self-determination, also about the right to follow the dictates of your own personal self-interests, and following that with the observation by some that this bill would discriminate against those who wish to have a self-determinant directive. How would you respond to those in the context of infringing upon the rights of those who would want to seek affirming counsel from professional clinicians of their choice, as opposed to restricting or prohibiting it outright?
Representative Cantrell.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, one of the things that I noticed from the testimony of all the testifiers, I want to thank everybody who came up and talked, but the testifiers who had been through this therapy and who kind of talked about their therapeutic experiences, many of them talked about how they went. There was one individual, I believe her name was Luca, said that she went to a practitioner who provided a space for her to safely and in an unbiased manner explore the questions of her gender identity. And what many of the testifiers talked about was going through therapies that were likewise unbiased, allowed for a space for an individual in a healthy way and constructive way to explore their gender and sexuality in a manner that would lead to self-navigation. But those therapies were self-directed. So actually, a lot of the therapies that were talked about would still be perfectly fine under this bill. If it's patient-directed, that's one thing. But if there is therapy with an agenda, if there is a practitioner who says, I have a therapy, at the end of which you won't be gay anymore, or you won't be someone who's transgender anymore, that is something that would no longer be allowed. There's a distinction in that patient self-determination component. Because what we know is that sexuality, gender identity are not mental illnesses. And so a therapy that has an agenda, has the distinct goal of changing someone's sexuality rather than providing an experience through which someone can better understand their sexuality, well, then that's one that's treating homosexuality and gender identity as a mental illness. And what we know from the experts who came up and testified for us, from the American Psychological Association and various others, is that that is no longer the standard of care. That is no longer the perspective through which bona fide therapies are conducted. So I would say that is the distinction that I would make in answer to your question.
Mm-hmm. Representative Albright, we've got a growing list. Can we come back to you?
Yes, put me on the list.
Thank you. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is the testifier from the Psychological Association still around? Can I ask you a question?
Please come to the testifier's table. Please state your name again.
My name is Dr. Margaret Charmley.
Thank you.
Dr. Charmley, in your professional opinion, what would be the difference between the therapy described by the first set of testifiers versus the second set of testifiers?
One of the concerns I had with the second set of testifiers is that there may have been a misunderstanding about what our position is from the American Psychological Association and the Minnesota Psychological Association. And by that I mean it's appropriate and good therapy within the context of people who are exploring their sexual orientation. If they have conflicts with their religious values, it's very important for a therapist to allow that person to openly explore their sexual orientation and their religious values and to honor both of those positions. Where we stand is that it is not acceptable to provide therapy with a distinct outcome in mind that changes sexual orientation. A number of people here testified that they had therapists that allowed them to fully explore their religious conflicts and their sexual orientation. That's good therapy. That's not what we're against. We're against someone that is promoting something with a specific outcome and not an outcome that allows the person to explore what that means for them. I hope that answered your question.
Thank you. Follow up, Dr. Mann.
I just wanted to make the point that this bill we're discussing today, we are talking about fake science. We have data going back decades that says that conversion therapy doesn't work. At best, it does nothing. And at worst, it causes significant trauma to those undergoing this procedure. What we're trying to do is prevent more people from undergoing that trauma. And not only from the procedure itself, but from the false promise that this is a thing that is going to change who they are. And it's been said multiple times already today, it doesn't prevent you from getting therapy if you need therapy. That is a whole different topic. And lastly, we need to stop telling people in the LGBTQ communities that there is something wrong with them and that they need to be changed. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Tarmelli. Chair Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I originally was raising my hand to respond to the question about or the comment about rulemaking, and I think Representative Albright correctly stated that we delegate the authority to make rules, but I think that it's really important in this case for us to draw a bright line here, and sometimes I have been reluctant to tell professional organizations who, after all, are the experts, what their practice should be. But in this case, it's very clear that the vast majority of practitioners have decided that this is not a legitimate therapy, that it is harmful. And I think for us then to put it into law and make a very clear, bright line is, in fact, the appropriate thing to do, not leaving it up to the boards through rulemaking, but giving it the force of law. I also want to point out that you could say, I think as Representative Albright saying, why do we have to do this? I think there is some sense of perhaps it's a belt and suspenders kind of approach. And that is something that we do all the time. We can say very clearly in law that this is not appropriate, this is not a real therapy, this is not something we accept in our state, and we can say to the boards, we want to make sure that because this is such a well-recognized position, that you'll all treat it as something that's unprofessional conduct. I don't find that inappropriate at all. I think it's very appropriate. Another point I just wanted to make, too, is that the way the bill is written is really very, it is pretty modestly written, I would say, in that it really is aimed at children and vulnerable adults. And so, I think that's important to point out, too. This is really about protecting people who may not be in a very good position to protect themselves. And I think that that is where the state really does have a responsibility to step in and make sure that people are protected until they are fully able to make their own decisions. Finally, it is important to note that as I read the bill, up until this point, theoretically at least, our Medicaid program could be paying for this therapy, and this bill makes it very clear that this is not something that is covered, that we do not recognize this as something that the public should be paying for. In fact, it should be something that is prohibited. So, even after all of the testimony, some of which, and I do appreciate all of the testifiers. I think it was, it is not easy to come to a public place like this. You're being recorded. You are in public and really open your soul to a bunch of strangers. And everybody who did that, we really do appreciate that, whichever side your opinion fell upon. But I feel really strongly that this is the right thing to do. This is not an overreach for the legislature. And, in fact, it's something that we really must do to protect the children of our state. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cantrell. Did you want to comment? I think that was just a statement by Chair Liebling. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just thought I wanted to reflect on the fact that this committee and the legislature for the 14 years that I've been here has historically always defined scope of practice in law. And sometimes we have very difficult decisions to make where one group of providers versus another says, oh, we're trained better than they are, they shouldn't be able to do it. And we routinely listen to the experts and listen to the best information we can have, and we weigh in on what is an appropriate scope of practice for anyone who receives a license from the state of Minnesota to practice in our healthcare system. And we have, I don't know, probably at least, it feels like 50 or more of those that we've seen at various points. And to me, this is our obligation to say to the public, we are looking out for you, to tell the education programs, this is what we want our practitioners ready to do and what we don't think they should do based on the research and our consideration of the information that we've gotten. And I think that the role of the licensing boards is much more narrow. If you look at the statute that's referenced here, it talks about how they have to verify that you had 2,000 hours of supervised oversight before you get your full license. You've gotten your training with 45 hours in this and 60 hours in that. And, yes, they do respond to complaints. They do respond to issues about whether someone is competent. It may be someone who's developing early Alzheimer's, and their patients start to understand that they're not, that someone ought to overview whether or not they can continue to practice in their field. But we've never left it to the licensing boards to decide the basic core services that we think should be available to everyone who has that license. And so I think that's important. The other thing I think we need to do is we're public policy developers. I think public policy should be developed by the people that the people elect to wrestle with difficult issues, to listen to testimony on both sides of an issue, to weigh the issues, and not to assume that it should be based on individuals filing complaints, filing lawsuits. We heard from both sides how difficult, how emotional this is for the people who went through it, whether they felt like it was a good experience in their life or a bad experience in their life. They all started it with nervousness in their voice. It takes a lot. They all went through a very difficult time, which is why they sought therapy or were recommended to have therapy, because they were clearly experiencing some dissonance and they wanted some assistance and guidance in dealing with that. And I hope that this is just another big step forward on a process that we have started long ago to help people with self-acceptance and acceptance by society that we are a big range of people. We are no longer just straight or gay or heterosexual or homosexual. We have bisexual people, some of whom will acknowledge that they're attracted to both, some of whom are trying to figure out if they're more attracted to one or another. We also have people who don't have much of a sex drive and are trying to figure what that means for them in their life. We have people who wrestle with gender, and as we learn more and more about genetics, we understand that it's much more complicated than we ever thought before. And I hope that we as a committee and as a legislature can continue to step on that path that says we want everyone to feel like they can be who they inherently are, who they believe if they have a faith that their God created to be who they are, and that who feel accepted in exploring the paths ahead of them and choose the one that has most meaning and most satisfaction and that will most enable them to give their gifts to the world. And that's my goal, and I think this is a step towards that. And so I want to thank you, Representative Cantrell, for bringing this forward.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I had a really practical question to ask, but Representative Loeffler, the comment you just made excluded one group, which is a group of people who have also a different viewpoint, that possibly they're struggling with their sexuality, but their faith is strong in their personal religion, whatever that might be, and they are looking for a different option, and you're saying that that voice cannot be allowed and it's against the law at this point. And that's what this bill does. But I honestly, that wasn't, I mean, you led us down that path is the only reason I brought that up, and you can respond to that. But I really wanted to ask a far more practical question, which is just as patients are, you know, going through this, would they be, how would they seek relief? Would they have to release the notes from their sessions, or how would one actually, in a practical application, how would they get relief on filing this complaint or getting the consequence of registering a complaint about this occurring?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pearson. So depending on the scope of the complaint, it could either, if it's going to law enforcement or if it's going to the licensing board, that would be up to the respective practices on a case-by-case basis of what the client has said. This, here is my complaint, here is my concern, this practitioner was doing X. So that really is, I think, a case-by-case kind of idea, and they might request notes from the meeting, they might request any amount of evidence that they would see necessary to thoroughly investigate whether or not a practitioner was engaging in this practice should this bill become law.
Representative Pearson.
And so then what would the outcomes of that be? Again, I just in a practical application, and if you want to ask somebody, you know, I'm assuming there are complaints in psychiatry in these areas outside of this that happen. Do they lose their license? What are the consequences?
Representative Cantrell.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Pearson. So in the bill, let's see if we can find it. So on the back, lines 2.1 to 2.3, mental health practitioner or mental health professional may be subject to disciplinary action by the licensing board of the mental health practitioner or the mental health professional. So it would be at the discretion of the board at what they choose to do, but we're delegating that authority in terms of pursuing proper relief to that board.
Representative Pearson.
Yeah, I guess that's really what I'm looking for. It's like, what are the specifics? What are the outcomes of this type of violation? And I don't just mean here. Again, I'm a real estate agent. Explain this to me. Like, I don't know what goes on for folks in that profession when they're then put in front of their board for discipline. Give me a practical example of what's going to happen to folks when these complaints are registered and filed.
Representative Cantrell, and if there are testifiers in the audience who can speak to this, please come to the testifiers table. Please state your name again.
Dr. Margaret Charmley. I'm without my gold leaf jacket. I forgot it at home when I went to eat, so sorry, you may not recognize me from today. I'm sorry. Would you please state the question?
Sure.
Again?
Representative
Pearson. Yeah, I'm so sorry. I don't mean to draw this out. Just on a practical level, when someone's brought in front of the discipline board then of you know, having violated not just this but anything, on what level or what type of discipline would someone who a practitioner face? First, I was asking, you know, is the person who's a victim of this, are there you know, their patient-client or doctor-patient confidentiality agreement, is that going to have to be opened up for these complaints to be registered, which, of course, is very sensitive to those people and individuals, the patients. And then additionally, then what type of discipline would be common for a violation of this sort, or just generally what types of disciplines are the boards empowered with?
Dr. Charmley.
Thank you. The answer to that is it depends. So if this were to become a law, then if a person violated the law and filed a complaint with the Board of Psychology and they were a client, their records would be open to the Board of Psychology in order to investigate the claim. So if I were, as a psychologist, were to have a complaint filed against me for how I practice psychology, I would have to release those records. So the client forecloses on their option of confidentiality if they bring a complaint before the board, because the board needs to fully assess what happened in those sessions. And they do that by looking at the notes of what happened. Did that answer your question, sir?
Representative Pearson.
It covers question one very well, but it opens up a section B then, which would be, could the person withdraw their complaint then at some point if they didn't want that exposure?
Dr. Charmley.
Well, once a complaint is filed, I think it goes to the board. So I don't know if people have actually withdrawn their complaints, because once the psychologist is called upon to release records, they have to go. Now, in terms of what kind of disciplinary action might happen, it depends on how egregious whatever somebody did was. So, you know, sometimes the board will say, we'll have an educational session. You know, we want you to be aware that you have done this, and we want you to have some additional training or to be under supervision. And sometimes in the case of more egregious disciplinary actions, people may have their license revoked.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, Chair, thank you. We know a number of us, all of us, got several emails and calls on this, and we had good testifiers. A couple questions that came to me, and if you could ask this here. What, under this law, what would happen if you had a religious ministry who wanted to advertise, hold a conference and advertise maintaining sexual purity? And in that conference, they encourage people who attended to avoid sexual activity outside of marriage, normal or homosexual or bisexual or anything. So what would happen under that? Different people have different interpretations on that. I mean, could you answer that, please? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Backer. So this bill doesn't at all prohibit people from selling tickets to conferences, selling a book about their experience going through conversion therapy. It doesn't prohibit any of that. It doesn't prohibit, like you said in your example, a religious ministry selling tickets to a purity conference in which they say, you know, abstain from sex before marriage or completely whatever the purpose of the conference is. None of that is covered at all in this bill. This bill is rather narrow in scope and says, if you, as a mental health practitioner, as an individual, are selling a service, portraying a service as being able to change someone's sexuality from whatever to heterosexual, that's what this is prohibiting. So they can absolutely still have their purity conference should this bill become law.
Okay. Follow-up, Chair.
Representative Backer.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Chair. Thank you. Okay, so explain to me the practical sense of you know, we heard a lot of testifiers for and against, and they were moving, and I appreciate that. But let's look at the practical sense. So someone comes into a therapist and are having the challenges. What would that therapist not be able to say? Or what could they say? Or what would they not be able to say under this? And you know, if there's a testifier that wants to help out, I'm okay with that. I've been getting these questions, hundreds of emails. So what would they be able to say, and what would they not be able to say, please?
May I? Dr. Margaret Charmley, I'm a licensed psychologist in the state of Minnesota here. My understanding is that what a therapist would not be allowed to say is that same-sex feelings and romantic attractions are pathological or a mental illness. That would be outside the scope of appropriate therapy. Within the context of appropriate therapy, it would be perfectly acceptable for a therapist to help an individual explore their religious values, and in some cases, some people resolve a conflict between their sexual orientation, if they have same-sex feelings, and their religious identity by being abstinent. Some people choose that route, and they're perfectly acceptable with that. So that would be fine to explore that.
Representative Badger.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for that. You know, one of the concerns that I've seen from several emails, even myself, is maybe you could tighten this up down the road, but the language is vague. I'm an EMT. I'm not a doctor. But from my practical experience, when A patient gets in the back of the ambulance, they do not give me direction. They're looking for direction. And that's a concern that I have. We have not had a tradition, and I would ask the author to look at this. We have a tradition, if I go to any therapist or doctor and ask for help, and they can't, this I see could limit them saying, hey, this is a choice. Because as we know, young people don't have the same experiences as we do around this table. They have not lived as long as I have, and so forth. So that's what really concerns me about that, that we're limiting that speech. We heard that, I think it was Jeremy, if I remember correctly, a father of three, was able to get that help. And for him, that was good. We also heard from Junior that the help he got was horrible and that was bad, you know, and so forth. But my concern is when someone comes to a patient, they are looking for help. The doctor or the therapist says, hey, here are the options. And I'm concerned that this would be limited as not one of their options for that patient to make the decision, like Jeremy made that decision and so forth. So that would be a concern, and would ask you to look into that, and that's a huge concern of mine. Thank you. That's all I have, Chair.
Thank you so much. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I first want to be able to, I've got basically a statement. First of all, I want to say thank you, Representative Hunter Cantrell, for bringing this forward. This is based on a bill that I first started 4 years ago, and I want to tell a little bit about where I came from on it and what we had gone through. Working at a homeless youth shelter, we deal with a lot of youth, ages 16 to 21, and probably one of the biggest frustrations that I've had over the years that I've been there is that sometimes the youth that have come to us don't make it. And when I say they don't make it, they end up dead. Sometimes it's around these issues. I remember one gentleman who had been with us. He had just turned 18. Several times before that, while he was under 18, he had left home. Because he was being subject to trying to cure him of being gay and going through different processes. He was not able to escape that until he finally turned 18 and ended up with us. At that point, he was in a major state of depression and quite suicidal. We were not able to help him. And he had to move on to an intensive therapy situation, and it was not a good situation. It's also not the first time that I've seen this over time, where we have youth who are homeless because their families have kicked them out and they're because of where they may be with their gender orientation or sexual orientation. And there have been several times where they're under 18, they are with us. They clearly need mental health and want to have some appropriate mental health treatment. But their parents at that point then decide to intervene because they are under 18. They can demand that the children be returned to them. And in those instances, they wanted them returned to go through their mental health therapy versus something that would have been more encompassing. These were some things that started raising me to take a look at the situation. And one of the things as I was doing research is that I found out over time is that in situations over the years, it has not been unusual when people are trying to be converted in a forced way. And remember now, we're just talking about people who are under 18 or vulnerable adults. Anyone who is of age is able to do what they would like and seek out the professional help they would like. But when you're under 18, you're trapped by your parents. You don't have that free choice to be able to get the help. And this is where the abuse starts coming in. And in many other areas, we allow abuse to be addressed. But when we're dealing with our youth in this type of situation, it becomes a whole different process. We have to make sure that we're setting up the protections there. When youth are being subjected or, and in some cases I would see it as abuse, they really don't have any ramifications. They don't have the protection that we're talking about. And in some of the areas where you might say, well, what about a report to child protection? Well, the person's turned 18. You know, by then, what can they do? And they are in such a state of dealing with the mental issues that they're surrounding, the self-actualization. They don't see themselves as a person. They feel that they aren't equal to everybody else. and seeing people trying to wrestle with the damage that has been done is part of the reason that I went into this. And it's not only the individuals themselves, but some of the research that I had looked into also showed the damage it had caused to some of the families. In some of the instances, it ended up where families were broke apart, divorce occurred. Suicide also happened to some of the other adult family members because they realized the damage that had occurred there. So it's not just the individual, but the long-term impact that then ends up happening to other family members. So it's not just the damage that might occur locally, but the damage that spins out from there. And that's why I'm very happy that you're putting this out there to address the situation. And I very strongly support it and encourage a yes vote on the bill.
Thank you. Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cantrell. boy, this is a tough committee. So thank you to everyone who has testified. This has been heart-wrenching from every side, so I really appreciate all of you who have spoken today. I know it's incredibly difficult, and this is certainly an issue that's very close to me, so I appreciate that. And I'll be honest, this is very close to me on both sides of this, which makes it especially difficult for me today. Certainly, I have people in my life who I would be horrified if they were treated as these young men were treated. And they've been able to make it to adulthood in beautiful and healthy ways, are in wonderful, long-term, healthy relationships and marriages, and I honor that and I appreciate that. I also have people who are very close to me who have made the choices that some of the folks behind me have made. And they also are living wonderful, successful, fulfilling lives with the choice that they have made. And so I have concerns about codifying the elimination of those choices for those who want it. And I, like I said, we've heard compelling testimony on both sides. So my questions really are very specific to the language, because I think the language is really important. And in fact, if we can, I know that we did have an attorney, Ms. Carlson. Is Ms. Carlson still here? If I could ask just a couple of questions.
Mrs. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had a lot of discussions, and we've been hearing a lot of questions about patient-directed therapies, and that would still be allowable under this language. As I read it, I have concerns, actually, that it would not be allowable. So I guess my question would be, in line 1.10, there's language that says that seeks to change at the end of that line. And I guess my question would be, is there a point at which that language becomes valid? And I guess what I mean by that is, if someone goes in and a therapist says, we're going to change this, I think that would obviously fall under this language. If someone comes in and says, I want to change, and then a therapist seeks to change, in it being directed by the patient, would that therapist now be liable under this language?
Ms. Carson.
Madam Chair, Representative, our concern is that this bill is entirely overbroad and vague. Specifically to that point, we do know that professional speech is protected speech, so that speech between the practitioner and the client is protected under the First Amendment. This bill obliterates that protection and undeniably infringes upon the rights of many Minnesotans in violation of their First Amendment constitutional rights. Under this bill, they would not be able to have the latitude that you explained.
Representative Duke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, you had mentioned, you know, Representative Backer gave this scenario of maybe a conference or something that would encourage abstinence or something along those lines. I also have concerns in line 1.11, that specifically says it includes efforts to change behaviors. And it goes on and talks about what that may mean. But could change behaviors, and again, I guess this would be for Ms. Carlson in trying to get a handle on the language. When we say change behaviors, could that actually include a conference encouraging abstinence? And, I mean, I understand, obviously, Representative Cantrell would say that this is a more narrow scope, but the way I read it is pretty broad, and that's concerning to me.
Ms. Carlson.
Madam Chair, Representative, I actually, with respect to that question, would draw your attention to Subdivision 7. The entire section, again, is overbroad, and I believe that you're speaking to an example that we gave in our analysis. And under that analysis, the concern is that this language prohibits people from certain behaviors, but it doesn't give guidelines as to what those prohibitions are. So under that language, we don't know, and that example seems to go along with the way it's described here, because it says reasonably interpreted or inferred. That's very broad language. It's vague language, and it's firmly unconstitutional, depriving Minnesotans of their rights under the United States Constitution.
Representative New.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is hands down my hardest vote in my short time in the legislature. But again, I appreciate the folks who have testified. I would echo Representative Liebling's comments that we want to protect children. And, you know, Ms. McBride visited with me in my office, and I appreciate that. And I expressed to her at the time that if I felt like the scope of this bill was limited to this prohibition, and particularly with the coercive therapies that these young men experienced, I would be 100% on board. I absolutely would be. I'm a little concerned that we would be dismissive of the folks behind us and their experiences as well. And I think we need to honor that. I would love to see some narrowing of the scope and the language. So that we really can get a handle on these practices that are, I mean, there are no words for how despicable some of these tactics have been. There are no words for that. And I'm certainly 100% on board for getting a handle on that. But I have real concerns that the scope of this bill is much broader than what we would intend, and I would hope that we would also honor the experiences of the folks who would seek these kinds of therapies. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Cantrell, would you like to respond to any of that? Or
I appreciate, or thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Representative Newman's feedback.
Okay. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Cantrell, and also Representative Fisher, because you really have been leading the way on this for several years now. I guess it strikes me, especially listening to Representative New and then the really the amazing testifiers, both for and against this bill, that this does bring up really powerful emotions and powerful issues, right? It's pretty core to so many of us, sexual orientation, gender identity, faith. Why are we even here in the world to a great extent? And I think it's so critical in this, regardless of your position, but I guess I'm especially, as somebody who is, you know, I'm in favor of this proposal, but especially speaking to those who spoke against and have been concerned by it, to make sure that we really are tied to the language of the bill and to specifically what it does. Because I was concerned in listening to some of the comments that we may not be so focused on that. And to focus that, and to recognize that those who are struggling the most with some of those issues are the people who are protected by this, those under 18, vulnerable adults, which is a term which has a pretty narrow meaning. There's a reference in the testimony to that. But if you look in the statute, it's quite narrow. And to recognize that there is a problem and a particular concern with an approach that is seeking in advance, has a preordained goal of doing something with respect to that person's sexual orientation or gender identity that says in advance we are seeking to change that. Representative Backer made the comment about that folks really, patients do come in and are seeking guidance, and that is definitely true. And I heard so many folks speaking in opposition to this saying, patients ultimately, individuals need to be in charge of their own treatment. They have to have the chance to set their own goals. And to my mind, that's exactly what this bill is doing. This is saying that support and understanding, as we heard from, I think it was Dr. Charmley, working with a patient to get to where that patient is at the best spot for that patient, with that patient's faith and that patient's background, everything with that patient, that's what this is about. But deciding in advance where the therapist comes in and says, this is my goal, is to change this person's orientation, that's the thing that is the concern. That's the thing where the therapist has decided, that's taking it out of the patient's hands at that point. So in my view, and I respect, I understand Representative New's concerns about the scope of this, but in my view, it really is written in a narrow way to say that when the goal is to change the behavior, when that's the preordained goal, that is prohibited. But stepping back from that, of course, having patients be able to work through issues with the support of a counselor of the type that we actually heard, oddly enough, surprisingly enough, we heard so much about that from those opposed to the bill when they talked about their own experiences with counselors. That's powerful. And that, in my view, would be permitted under this and should continue to be permitted, and I would believe that it certainly would be. So I think it's important that we listen to physicians, to psychiatrists, to those who are telling us what the standard of care is and what their expertise is. I will say, having looked through a number of these concerns expressed about the legal implications, I don't see, it seems to me that many of these are quite a stretch in my view. If the goal is to seek to change the individual orientation, to practice by a mental health practitioner, et cetera, that is barred. Many of the other situations, in my view, are not. And this is necessary protection for those who are greatly vulnerable, and particularly vulnerable, as described by Representative Fisher in his work with homeless youth and with others. So thank you so much for bringing this forward. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cantrell, and all of the witnesses who have been with us today. We have greatly benefited from all of your testimony, so thank you. I also have concerns about the scope, and so I have two questions regarding that. The first question, in especially Section 1 and 2, it talks about mental health practitioners or mental health professionals. And it seems like from some of the testimony that they were receiving counseling from people who may not have fit that category, people who are clergy or lay persons who provide prayer, other ways of counseling people. So I just wondered, how does this bill affect people who are not meeting the definition of mental health professional? Either one of you.
Okay, who would like to take that? Well, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Robbins, for your question here. To assist in answering your question, I'm going to recall Ms. McBride to the testifiers table, please.
Madam Chair, I apologize for interrupting. May I respond to that as well, following?
Yes, Ms. McBride, please. Can you restate your name again?
Yep, Emma McBride.
Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins, this bill I think is really simple, especially the second part, which actually uplifts our current consumer protection laws that say that you cannot sell a service for money that is promising to do something that it cannot. So what the second part of this legislation seeks to do is uplift that. It says that you cannot sell conversion therapy for money if you promise to change someone's gender identity, expression, or someone's sexual orientation. We've heard from many doctors and experts here today that that is not a promise that you can make, that conversion therapy is not effective. So that's what this bill seeks to do.
Thank you. Robin.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would the other lawyer wish to come back and respond? I don't know where she went.
Ms. Carson.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Representative, the language in this bill, if you look at specifically line 212, says any person or entity. Again, that is an example of the broad and sweeping language of this bill, and it doesn't read as something that is narrow.
Representative Robin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Cantrell and the other testifier. That was related to my second question about scope, because I do think in the first two sections it specifically says mental health practitioner or mental health professional, both in the definition and the prohibition, but in subdivision 7 it strays from that and it says no person or entity. So it seemed to leave the narrowness of mental health professional. So I just wondered, Representative Cantrell, if you could address that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Robbins. So this bill is twofold in its impact. So it prohibits mental health practitioners, mental health professionals from engaging in conversion therapy, but it also contains a component of adding on to our consumer protection statutes, that's 325F.69, that says, look, you're not going to be able to sell a fraudulent good with a fraudulent promise in the state of Minnesota. That's something that is quite, honestly, I think a standard that we all can get behind, especially when that good leads to long-term detriment to an individual's health and well-being. So that's why we included that component, Representative Robbins.
Thank you for clarifying. I appreciate that.
Representative Robin?
Nothing further. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pinto kind of made my point, actually. Thank you. I think that the premeditation of this really separates it. And I can speak personally from having had several patients who have gone through conversion therapy. I think we've kind of gotten away from how punitive this is. It often involves extreme shaming, sometimes physical abuse, sometimes sexual abuse. This is a horrifying practice, and I just wanted to add that. So thank you for bringing this forward, Representative Cantrell.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't think anyone disagrees around this table with the intent that Representative Cantrell has brought forward. At our core, we spoke about that. It is about safety for the public. First and foremost, I think Representative Pinto said it very, very well. When you are soliciting under false pretense, when you are soliciting or misrepresenting what your service or good could provide, or with the knowledge of a predetermined outcome based upon a request, but to some extent, those objections have already been addressed by consumer protection laws that are already on the books. If you take a look at, and this may be an op-ed, and then I'll have both the attorney for the ACLU as well as for the attorney that's at the table already, and maybe I'll pose it in a question and see how both of you respond to it. The Supreme Court has issued several rulings, and I'm happy to provide this document to everyone else so that you can take a look at it. But they make a statement with regard to a ruling on marijuana, but it has bearing on this. It says, as with other kinds of speech, regulating the content of professional speech poses the inherent risk that the government seeks not to advance a legitimate regulatory goal, but to suppress unpopular ideas or information. Furthermore, it says when the government polices the content of professional speech, it can fail to preserve an uninhibited marketplace of ideas in which the truth will ultimately prevail. And in the final conversation comment, it says, the best test of truth is the power of the thought to get itself accepted in the competition of the market. And the people lose when the government is the one deciding which ideas should prevail. So in the context of the recent Supreme Court precedent that talks about Second Amendment, these rulings, I understand you are an attorney, and is it Mr. Feist? If you could, if he would come down. Thank
so
you.
Why don't we have Ms. Carson respond first, and then Mr. Feist.
Let me pose the question, okay, because I think it's helpful. We're deliberating about, and I had a sidebar with a couple of people. There seems to be a divergence of understanding with regard to the kind of the preamble in Subdivision 1 and how it connects with Subdivision 7, which really goes to the point of what Representative New and others have expressed as well. So with regard to rulings such as McCollum versus Coakley, and I know that these are just being thrown out, but Abrams versus United States, aren't we suppressing the speech of professionals by interceding in the patient-provider relationship with this type of language?
Ms. Carson.
Madam Chair, actually the Supreme Court has spoken to that exact point recently on this very idea of the so-called conversion therapy ban bills in the recent NIFLA v. Becerra case of 2018, where they actually said that professional speech is not entitled to any less protections under the First Amendment than any other speech. And so the way this bill is drafted doesn't read to me like something that's drafted to regulate conduct, but rather a direct attack on speech based on content and viewpoint to silence people who have a different opinion than the authors of this bill. And the Supreme Court's rulings and holdings support that contention. The Supreme Court, in fact, in NIFLA also made mention of two other courts stating that their description of a very similar bill, but actually narrower, was in fact erroneous when those courts held that the bills were constitutional because they were simply a regulation of conduct. In addition to that, you also know that the Supreme Court has said that professional speech, again, doesn't deserve any less protection under the First Amendment. And I'll just draw your attention to one more thing, a case just coming out of Florida. The district court there also granted an injunction for a bill for actually a law that was passed, similar to this, but again, a lot narrower. It didn't involve vulnerable adults, which is a caveat. The statute here in Minnesota, vulnerable adults, includes those adults who simply have physical infirmities, meaning that it also includes people who are entirely competent, but just need assistance for their physical capacity. So again, going back to the Florida case, the district court held that the plaintiffs in that case, challenging a very similar but narrower law, which only applied to minors, did in fact establish a likelihood of success on the merits based on their First Amendment claims. So I would urge members here to consider that these bills are quite new. They're just coming out. The courts are beginning to weigh in on them, and they're beginning to say these are a flagrant violation of our First Amendment rights.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Carson. Mr. Feist, would you like to respond to the question?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Ben Feist, the ACLU of Minnesota. Thanks for the question. It's a good one, Representative. And what I can say, first off, the ACLU takes free speech really seriously. I think everybody should know we often get in trouble because we are defending the free speech rights of folks who may not share other views with our organization on other issues or in any other number of things. So we take free speech incredibly seriously.
And when looking at a case like this, it's clear that although constitutionally protected, physicians' professional communication may be reasonably restricted under a series of case law that's out there. I can't speak directly to the cases that you're citing and give a legal opinion of that right now, but there is a test that you go through when looking at this, and one of the main things that you're going to look at is, you know, what are the norms in the medical community? If this is outside of regular practice, it may be a lot easier to find this to be a reasonable restriction. And again, I can't say exactly how the courts would approach this, but I do want to distinguish. I understand generally that the Florida case was a different bill than this one. Same idea here, but went at it in a different way. And so I think that is distinguishable. And I should note as well that in Illinois, this issue has also come up with something a little bit more on point, and to my knowledge, this has been upheld currently under law. So certainly not settled. These are issues that can be debated and will be debated. But at this point, again, from the ACLU perspective, this bill looks to be on pretty solid ground.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, I won't have any more questions, but I think, you know, the comments made by both sides on this issue, I think I come down to share the concerns that it is unsettled. This is, the practice is wholly horrific, terribly unsettling, and I would defend a person's opportunity to find those that have done them wrong, you know, find them out. And that's, I think, the purpose of Representative Cantrell's legislation. But the breadth, Representative Cantrell, I think you've heard from other people, is it's not nebulous. It is with question that still poses some concerns, as expressed by others and myself. I think as the bill follows its track, I would hope that you would be open to suggestions about how to tighten up some of the language, some of the definitional connections, the sinews that put this together. I do appreciate your tenacity and your perseverance. We always, in the policy, we never try to suggest that we're impugning the integrity of the author. But we are fierce about making sure that the policy is right. So I appreciate your willingness to weather the storm, if you will. Thank you.
And to that, Representative Albright, you know, I just want to remind the members that this bill will be traveling to Commerce, where we're going to have deeper discussion around those issues and factors. Representative Pinto?
I guess, Madam Chair, I'll just say this really briefly. I just wanted to just note in that Subdivision 7 that we've been talking about that it simply restricts, if you look on lines 2.12 to 2.14, there has to be fraud, false pretense, false promise, false guarantee, misrepresentation, false or misleading statements, deceptive practice. Everything else in that subdivision is qualified by those phrases. You can't use those sorts of concepts. You can't be fraudulent. You can't speak falsely, et cetera, when advertising product services, et cetera. This is directed at conversion therapy services in particular. And so I guess that's where I would certainly agree with Mr. Feist. I know from all kinds of experience how fierce the ACLU is in protecting free speech. If they say this is on solid ground, this is on solid ground. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I find it kind of rich that when it comes to a bill like this, we start talking about protecting professional speech and the patient-doctor relationship. When it comes to other things, like women's health, for example, we are trying to prevent physicians from telling their patients all their facts. But I'm sure we will talk about that another day. What I was going to say is that I think we're spiraling a little bit. I feel like the bill is pretty straightforward. It's just saying that we cannot offer a service that is a hoax. and we need to protect people from that. In fact, you know, just to bring that point home, we have a physician's database that we can go into and type anything we want, how to treat depression, how to set a broken bone, whatever. And when I type in conversion therapy, nothing comes up. Nothing. I get management of potentially resectable colorectal cancer liver metastasis, the treatment of Mycobacterium avium complex lung infections. It doesn't exist because it's not a real medical thing. And that's all we're saying, is that we shouldn't be able to provide things that aren't real to people.
Thank you, Representative Mann. Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice having some doctors on this committee, and it's kind of hard to follow them. I don't think I can top anything that uses the word colorectal.
Please don't.
So I was more, I'm more used to like the line of reasoning that Representative Pinto was kind of following, and I was kind of going to go along those lines, but that might be because you, in addition to having a couple of doctors on this committee, you have a couple of lawyers on this committee. So he mentioned just, this is, you know, that this is a narrow bill. He mentioned that it requires, you know, if you look at line 2.13, it requires a false promise, a false guarantee, as Representative slash Dr. Mann said, a hoax, basically. And it's limited even further than that. If you go down to line 2.15, it's got to be, for it to violate this section, it has to be something that reasonably could be interpreted or inferred as representing homosexuality as a mental disease, disorder, or illness, or guaranteeing. You know, not just saying maybe we can, but to violate this, it has to be a statement that guarantees a change in an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. And we know, we've heard from psychologists, we've heard from doctors, we've heard from therapists, we've heard from NAMI, that that's not something you can do, and when you try to do it, it's extremely harmful. You know, it was mentioned that because at the beginning of line 2.12 it uses the words person or entity, that somehow that makes this overbroad because it applies to any person or entity. But this is, you know, I'm not used to, this isn't the Commerce Committee, I'm not used to looking at the Commerce statutes, but this is in the Commerce section of law, section 325F.69, unlawful practices. You know, this would add a new subdivision 7. If you look to subdivision 6, it's deceptive use of a financial institution name. First thing it says there is, no person shall include the name, trade name, or logo. Section before that, section 5, prohibited going out of business sales. It is illegal for any person to represent falsely that a sale is a going out of business sale. This is entirely consistent with those other sections of the consumer protection statutes. It uses the same language. It's not overbroad. It's actually a very narrow bill that targets a very narrow and very harmful practice. I applaud you, Representative Cantrell, for bringing this forward. If I'm not mistaken, you're 23 years old. When I was 23 years old, I was not sitting in front of legislative committees speaking about really harmful practices like this. I really admire your courage in taking this on. I think this is a great bill, and I think we all need to support this.
Representative Pearson.
Thank you. Just, again, kind of practical, definitional question that has been kind of haunting me ever since I didn't get asked if I had a follow-up question earlier. And I was going to let it go, but I can't. Can you, Representative Cantrell, the term gender expressions isn't defined in law that I'm aware of. What's the intent of that term?
Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Pearson,
Sure.
Here, I found it. 1.12. Thank you. So let's see here. So that seeks to change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity, including efforts to change behaviors or gender expressions. You know, I think if, Madam Chair and Representative Pearson, I think if we are considering this statute in the context of the medical practice and the medical services, mental health services being offered by professionals, I think that it can be reasonably interpreted that that there are qualities of gender expression that as one of my testifiers was talking about earlier, and this is just one example. That may be viewed as coming from somebody who identifies as a man, as being effeminate, And so when we are looking at the context of this statute, and we are looking at the practice that this statute seeks to prohibit, it is harmful, and that's what the statute is outlining. It is harmful to make somebody behave in a way that at least if you're promising a therapy that might make somebody not gay anymore, that might make them act more masculine, that might change the way that they express their gender identity with an intended goal. It is actually in the Safe Schools Bill in Minnesota law. So we do have gender expression codified there as well. So I think broadly what this aim is to ensure that we are not allowing this practice, this very narrow practice that has an agenda to change something that promises to change something specific about a person, in this case their sexuality or their gender identity, but seeks to affirm what the patient's own kind of conclusions and growth to reach an understanding of what their gender identity, their gender expression, their sexuality may be. So, Representative Pearson, I hope that might shed a little bit more light on your question.
Representative Pearson?
Not really, because it doesn't go to the very, because it is a very loose term, and I don't know if under the Safe Schools is it defined, the term gender expressions, is it defined under the Safe Schools bill? It might be used, but is it defined anywhere?
Oh, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Pearson. One moment.
I'm hearing no.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Pearson, although it is not defined in the Safe School statute, it is also mentioned. So just kind of going back to your point about, while it doesn't have a solid definition, it is mentioned elsewhere in our statutes.
And I appreciate that. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative Pearson.
And I appreciate that, and I certainly understand that the context is important, right? And I fully get it. But the term gender is still very much so being discussed, debated, and multiple definitions of what people mean just by what they say when they say gender. When we say gender expressions, that could mean how an individual identifies, or it could mean a physical characteristic. A high-pitched voice for a man may be a gender expression that you're saying a mental health practitioner could not say that they're going to help somebody with a predetermined goal. And that's how I'm reading this. And again, I'm just trying to help build the statute to be, assuming it's signed into law, it becomes a statute, right? But just trying to make sure that we're not overreaching and creating what Representative Mann had talked about, really tying the hands of that patient and doctor relationship and not allowing practitioners to do that. You know, I also think of, because it also says reduce sexual or romantic attractions, feelings towards others, eliminate. Oh, you know, that's actually all right. I was trying to make sure we're not outlying a nymphomaniac or someone who actually has a mental disorder that we're going to try to, because we're reducing sexual feelings in that situation, and that's, you know, if you're broadly defining this as it's written, someone who has that ailment, that's seeking professional help, and the practitioner is saying they can help that person, to me this law is actually forbidding that, and that's just a couple of narrow scope things that I'm picking off. So, and again, maybe that doesn't apply. The gender expressions, though, is just such a broad term. And I, again, feel like under definitions, a little more time should be taken on some of these very far-reaching terms.
Xenophana.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. My question is actually, I think, possibly for Dr. Charmley, if she's still here, or possibly Sue from NAMI.
Representative Dr. Margaret Charmley.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Cantrell, Dr. Charmley. So there's been a little piece during this discussion that has been really nagging at me. And specifically, you know, we've kind of been talking a little bit about sort of the it seems like we're in some ways we're asking about the need for this, right? And is this absolutely necessary? Do we need to do this? Do we, from a public safety perspective, from the perspective of protecting our children, do we need to do this? And I guess one of the things that no one has really brought up that seems to bother me is we talked a lot about choice, and we talked a lot about the difference between leading someone down a path and guiding them to their own path. And I think this law specifically is aimed at adolescents and folks under the age of 18. We had a testifier who was talking about being led to therapy as early as age 10, I believe it was. And I don't know about the rest of the folks in this room, but at age 10, even at 12, age 15, I think we all, just like a little child, right? We look back at our parents to see how they're going to react because we want that love and acceptance. And I think about that a great deal as we've been talking about choice and whether adolescents are able to choose for themselves their course of therapy. And I guess my question is this. You know, in your experience, or as a professional, are children generally in a place where they are feel empowered that they could speak up and say if a course of therapy is not okay, or are they more likely to go along with something because they feel that it's what their parents want and they want that love and acceptance? I guess that's what that keeps nagging at me during this, and I don't think that's been addressed.
Dr. Charmley.
So you are asking whether or not a child is able to make an informed decision mm-hmm. about treatment. And I would say most likely not in some cases, that it requires some adult discretion and decision making in order to make decisions of that nature. Just like you wouldn't expect a child to make a decision about having brain surgery. We need to have guidance on that.
Representative Madam Chair, thank you. And that said, I mean, I guess the part that second piece of that that's nagging at me is, to me, it feels like the definition of convergent therapy has been fairly well outlined, and we understand the difference between allowing someone to explore their sexuality through therapy in a healthy way, or being forced down a specific path. And I guess my question is, you know, if adolescents are not in a place where they could truly advocate for themselves, number one, it feels to me a little bit like this provision is more important than ever. But I'm wondering, you know, in your professional opinion, you know, is it, I don't know how to say this in a good way, is it appropriate, or is there some remedy that therapists can employ when they feel that a parent is perhaps pushing a child down a path that they perhaps want that is not healthy or in line with the child's wishes?
Dr. Charmley.
Could you elaborate on your question, please, in terms of what path they're being pushed down?
Please. Right. So I think we talked a little bit about, you know, being able to explore and talk about your own sexuality and health way. Obviously, we discussed that's good therapeutic practice. But I know, you know, this provision specifically talks about
in advance pushing someone into a therapy where we're talking about changing their gender identity specifically, that we are telling them that something is not okay. We have talked about the fact that telling them that something is a mental defect or that is somehow wrong, which we know is according to the law, not okay, right? But if a child is being pushed down a road such as that, I'm trying to understand where a therapist could potentially push back on that and say something if they feel like the child is in jeopardy in some way around that.
Thank you very much for clarifying that. One of the resolutions that came out of the task force report of the American Psychological Association on appropriate therapeutic responses to sexual orientation was that of, and I read part of it earlier in my testimony, was that parents, guardians, and so on are advised against seeking therapy that promises to change sexual orientation. What I didn't finish, which was also part of that resolution, was that they are instead sought to seek therapy that helps them explore and understand and seek social support and get accurate information about sexual orientation and gender identity. So it to help a parent to understand what that means, what it is, what some of the pros and cons are in regard to what we know about the scientific research.
Thank you.
Representative Bonner.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. One last question, I promise. And that is a little bit, there was a line of questioning that came up earlier, and we were talking a little bit about reporting things when they were not appropriate. And we're specifically talking about a group of individuals who are vulnerable, right? They're conflicted, perhaps. And they're looking for guidance to go down a path. And I, because of that vulnerability, you know, we talked a little bit about what if, you know, if someone were to report that they were perhaps being led down a path that was not appropriate therapeutically. And I guess my concern is that because they're vulnerable adults, how likely is it that these folks who are maybe seeking that love and affection from family or they're conflicted, that they would be likely to speak up and share if they were being abused or led down a path that they may not even realize is detrimental that we as adults should be aware of?
Dr. Shomerly.
So you're asking how likely a person might be to advocate for themselves and to make a statement? You know, I think that depends on the individual. There are some young people that seem to know that something is wrong and they report it and they make a scene. Many people don't because they are under the influence of, you know, wanting to be loved, as you say. Another parallel experience is how many women report sexual assault. And sometimes they wait years to report it because, for whatever reason, it doesn't feel like they may be heard or understood. So people are, there's a variety and a variance in terms of what would prompt somebody to say something.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you. Just that they may not be in a place to feel safe. I appreciate
yes.
that. And thank you for your indulgence in this line of questioning. I really appreciate your opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to call for a roll call on this vote.
Okay, thank you. Is there any further discussion? All right, so hearing none. So the chair renews her motion that House File 12 be recommended for re-referral to the Committee on Commerce. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Yes.
Vice Chair Morrison?
Yes.
Minority Leader Keel? Representative Albright? No. Representative Backer?
No.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Edelson?
Yes.
Representative Fisher?
Yes.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Liebling? Representative Loeffler?
Yes.
Representative Mann?
Yes.
Representative New?
No.
Representative Pearson?
No.
Representative Pinto?
Yes.
Representative Robbins?
No.
Representative Schumacher?
No.
Representative Schultz?
Yes.
Okay, there have been 10 yes and 6 no's. The motion prevails. House File 12 is recommended for re-referral to the Committee of Commerce. So I just want to state that our next meeting will be on Tuesday. Excuse me, we're not done yet. Excuse me, we're not completely done. Thank you. I have a few an announcement. Our next meeting will be on Tuesday, February the 19th, at 2:30, room 200 in the State Office Building. The hearing is now adjourned.